Russia have just paid the last installment of all the debts of the Soviet Union. That means after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was initially agreed that all former Soviet republics would take their share of the debt of the Soviet Union, but most of them refused, so Russia took over all the debt for the whole of the Soviet Union, and now since Putin has been president, he has been repaying that, and now last week was the last repayment, so they paid back $105 billion in debt.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Bit of a silly name, isn't it? But we used to be on the community radio before getting elbowed off by Pat Hart, who, by the way, has just been promoted to work at the BBC. Patrick Hart's a very close personal friend of Mayor Marvin Rees, who took over the community radio and actually elbowed out the two people that founded Bristol Community Radio. That is Phil Gibbons and Joanne Schofield, and then he elbowed me off. But we had something like 12 years on there, on the local community radio every week doing politics, so we've got to know the dynamics of the city pretty well, all the way back to the days when there was no mayor. And we're streaming live on the talkradio.org.uk stream on the 2nd of February, that's Friday the 2nd of February, 2024, from the Pink Horse Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre, and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. The best one, of course, though, is Aurora. You can download that, and then you can actually delete or disable Google Play from your Android phone and get all of the apps without Google Play filtering them. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with all the military-grade propaganda, the psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution. Not only said Fourth Reich there, Fourth Industrial Revolution. Of course, we do love you, Klaus Schwab. We think you're great, especially in your spacesuit. And is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We'll be talking to Martin about the looming possibility, actually, of a vote on a United Ireland as well a little bit later. Joining me in the studio is Julia Parker and Stephen Pill, both site reps on the Metford Road allotments. Now, I'm sure some regular listeners are going to be thinking, oh, God, no, he's not going to go on about allotments. Allotments are so important. Allotments connect us with our past, our history. Before the medieval enclosures, pretty much everybody had a plot of land, actually quite a large plot in their village, before mass urbanisation. And, of course, the French, for example, have got a very close connection with the land. We in Britain, through the Industrial Revolution and urbanisation, these are our little lungs that we've still got. We can still grow our own food. We can still grow flowers for our loved ones, things like that. Many people, of course, in these high-rise blocks have got no access to land whatsoever. That's why allotments are so important. And they're trying to jack up the prices. We'll be hearing much more about that and about the consultation process. We'll be also looking at, as I said, the Northern Ireland process, with a little bit of advice from Lord Peter Mandelson. He's an interesting character, of course, in the Labour Party. He talks like he's an insider. Like, when you hear him, he's like, well, I know what's going on because we're steering this, me and my City of London friends. So it'd be interesting to hear what he's got to say about the restoring of the Stormont Assembly this week. And finally, in the final hour, we'll be hearing from former ambassador to Syria Peter Ford, talking about this letter today, which has been released by 800 diplomats from Britain and the United States, not just diplomats, but workers in the Foreign Office and the State Department, with their concerns about possible complicity with the Israeli genocide in Gaza. So it'd be interesting to see what he's got to say about that. Also, I did an interview this week with Laurent Guillenot. He's the filmmaker that made a film a couple of years ago called Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers, which makes a lot of interesting connections to do with the US policy towards Israel and the demise of the Kennedys. So, Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. And us, cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia. but not cancelled here yet. So, Julie, maybe we could start with you, Julie Parker. So what your, can you tell us a little bit about your allotment, which is, as you've told me, the Metford Road allotments? Whereabouts are they in the city, and when did you first arrive there?
The Metford Road allotments are in Redland, which is about 1.5 miles from the city centre. And Steve, my husband, and I had our first allotment 20 years ago. And we'd never done any sort of gardening before. It was very much an experiment, and we started out with a very small plot. And after the first growing season, we were absolutely hooked. And at that time, half of the site was derelict, a situation which has radically changed. And we were able to expand our plot.
Hang on, so you took over neighbouring plots, you started growing more. So
that's right.
It works, I think, isn't it 10 poles or something? It's because they use these old measurements of land for allotments, at least they did originally. So how big roughly is it?
Nowadays they use metres.
Oh,
our plot is it's just under 150 square metres.
Right,
that
well,
was our first plot.
Would you like to tell me, because I would imagine once you started, you either, because quite a lot of people get started with allotments and then they have a couple of seasons maybe of not growing successfully and ending up going home with all this dirt under their fingernails, and they think to themselves, ooh, well, this isn't really for me. So what do you make of this whole thing about people, some people having green fingers and some not?
I think you need to learn what you're doing, but you're never on your own, because there are always other allotmenters around to give you advice. There's a lot of advice on the internet, and you get better as you get more experience. It's certainly a challenge to deal with the slugs and the snails and the other pests, and it can be very discouraging, having planted your crops, to find that the slugs and snails have had the benefit of them all. But you do find ways, organic ways, of dealing with that. If that wasn't the case, we wouldn't have stuck at it for 20 years.
So slugs and snails, give us a few tips then, could you? These, I mean, these are clearly nasty little things. We used to spend our youth pouring salt on the slugs.
And, oh dear.
That's actually, I may have even been organic salt, I'm not sure. It certainly wasn't too destructive. But what are the best ways to deal with basic things like that?
Well, I think people find their own ways. One very common one, although it's a bit pricey nowadays, is to put out beer traps. And the slugs and snails are attracted to those. They crawl into them and drink themselves to death, basically. Not very pleasant.
Well, I shouldn't imagine it's such a terrible way to die.
Die happy.
Martin?
as a slug, I'd say, bring it on, yeah.
But yeah, okay. So what you're doing is you've got what, like, say, I don't know. I'm guessing a pint glass, and put that in the ground with a. Do they crawl up and over the top and into it?
You'd put a little bowl, a little shallow pool,
right?
And they crawl into it. You'd put it into the ground. So, but they're very good climbers, slugs and snails. But my own belief is that one of the reasons that we suffer so very much from slugs and snails is that we have done an excellent job, unfortunately, over the years, of getting rid of their predators. So where are the hedgehogs that used to predate them?
Of course, yeah.
Where are the thrush, the song thrush, that used to predate them? And we're suffering now with the fact that we have severely reduced the populations of those predators.
Well, I've got some friends who have a big market garden, and they have ducks. Apparently, they love slugs,
yes.
And they will take out the. So, if you've got a big enough plot, and there, I suppose there is also just generally with the allotments, and because you're an allotment rep as well, site rep, you must come across this sometimes. Well, you may do, where one person is simply not really looking after their plot very well, and so maybe the seeds or the pests from that plot are annoying the neighbours.
That's right, and that can happen. Also, if there are vacant plots that we haven't been able to let for some reason, they do become little sanctuaries for the pests, and slugs and snails use their slime trails as chemical signals, and when there aren't any slime trails around, they know that there are no other slugs or snails. So these areas might be, neighbouring areas might be good to migrate to for fresh food. So yes, it can be a problem.
Okay.
And that's one reason why you always want to keep grass and vegetation and weeds around your plot very short, so that there aren't hiding places for those pests.
Okay, so can you take us through the sort of things that you're growing on your plot?
Well, I always, when I'm asked that, I think back to when I was a beginner, and I asked the then site rep, who was a marvellous man in his 80s, who'd been allotmenting for all his life, and I said, "What do you grow?" And he said to me, "Everything." And I thought to myself, "Well, that's not helpful." What do you mean? Yes, I would say everything we can. So the staples like onions and garlic and potatoes, then things like pumpkins and carrots, beetroot, green things like lettuce. Come and help me out.
Kale, fennel.
Broad beans.
Globe artichokes.
Cucumbers, tomatoes.
And we haven't mentioned fruit yet, so berries of all sorts.
Celeriac.
And some exotic ones, jostaberries, which are combinations of gooseberries and blackcurrants. They produce huge blackberries, which make marvellous jam. Yeah. You'll never get that in a shop.
Yes, that's one of the many joys. So we also grow white currants and pink currants, as well as red currants, which are better known about. Those are the sorts of things you can't get in the shops, and that is one of the joys of allotting, is being able to grow things that aren't readily available in the shops.
How do you find the time to do it?
You have to make the time, and I think in our case, we were both working full-time when we started. It can be a bit of a challenge, but if you're committed to it, what we found is that it very much changed the way we live, and allotmenting became central to our lives, not just an add-on. And so, for instance, it's changed the time of year we take holidays. Right. So we don't go on holiday in the summer, because that's the time when all your crops are producing, and it doesn't seem right to go away and leave your crops to spoil. So we tend to go away for a holiday in the winter when we don't have so much in the ground.
And I think I would add that it is entirely practical to have an allotment with a job. You just have to constrain things a little bit. It takes some intensive time to knock things into shape, to get in control to start with. But once in control, the key thing is to go little and often. So every night after I'd come back from work, I'd go direct to the allotment, spend half an hour, perhaps less than that. And if you pull the weeds out when they're tiny, it's no trouble, takes no time. I think some people have the wrong idea and imagine that they can plant their seeds and come back 2 months later and harvest. And that just doesn't work, because the weeds grow faster than the crops you've got. And once the roots are intertwined, then it's a real mess to try and disentangle them. But keeping on top of it with a little time very frequently is the way. Mm. And that's the sense in which it has to become incorporated into life plans. And I think along with what Julie said about us changing our life style to accommodate the growing, we change the way we eat to accommodate the crops, so that now we don't eat beans except when beans are in season. And so every year at this time of year, we start thinking, oh, it'll be 3 months till the beans come in. And we really look forward to that. And there is absolutely nothing like eating an in-season crop when it's at the peak of perfection in freshness and taste, and when you've not had it for a long time.
Freshly shelled peas. Yes. I can remember that as a kid, being wheeled to the allotment in a wheelbarrow by my father.
I was just going to say that one of the things our culture teaches us is that to be happy, we have to have everything we want all the time, whenever we want
it. On demand, yes.
On demand. Mm, yeah. And what allotmenting teaches you is, as Steve has said, that a period of deprivation is actually fantastic for enhancing your appreciation of something when you have it. And there really is nothing like eating fresh broad beans or fresh green beans when you haven't had them for 6 or 9 months. It's a much lovelier way to live, and it teaches you appreciation as well.
Not to mention taste, because I went to boarding school, and we did have plums occasionally, and they were golf ball-sized purple rubbery things, which had no taste, and we had broad beans, which were rubbery and tasted terrible. So when we came to our allotment and Julie first mentioned the idea of growing broad beans, I couldn't think why, what the point of that was. And it was completely transformed by the experience of eating a fresh one once it came from the ground. And for people who like sweet corn or who think they like sweet corn, then they have no idea just how heavenly the taste can be if you, and the saying goes, you saunter slowly down to your plot to pick it and then run back quickly to the pot to cook it. And sweet corn cooked fresh like that within an hour of being picked has a flavour that's just unmatchable.
What about failures? Have you had any, you really put a lot of time and effort into a new kind of crop or even one that's been there for a while, but at the end of the day, there's nothing to harvest or it's just not worked at all?
Oh, absolutely.
That's part of the magic, because every year there are failures of one sort or another. And as the climate changes and the weather patterns become unpredictable, it reduces plants' ability to fight off diseases. So fungal diseases after a long wet period can knock out crops. We've really come to appreciate the role of farmers in the life of the country and the risks that they face in trying to bring crops in. So there are always failures, but also there are unexpected successes, and it's all part of this very complex system that we don't fully understand that goes on around us. And it's one of the entertaining things, is working out from one year to another, well, what can we do a bit differently this year? Thinking about it is part of the fun.
And allotments really teach you humility, because you start out by growing, say, beans, and then next year you do all of the same things that you did last year when you had a successful crop, and you find it doesn't work. And that teaches you that there are other factors outside your control which are responsible also for growing your crops. And so it always keeps you humble. You always feel you have something to learn. You have to pay close attention to the variability of the seasons, because if spring is late this year, well, it's not going to be any use putting my seeds in the ground because it's still too cold. So you have to watch the seasons and learn from them and adjust your behaviour to have success.
Yes, but we have this consultation going on now at Bristol around allotments. There seems to be almost something sort of last minute and maybe even perverse about the way that our Labour Mayor, Marvin Rees, has left this right to the very end of his tenure as Mayor, and he's going to leave it to the Greens to implement this, supposedly. So, Stephen, I know you've had quite a bit to do with the whole process. Can you just take us through what's been going on and where we are at down the road?
How much of the picture do you want?
Well, how did it start? When did you first hear there was going to be a new regime?
When I first heard of it was the second week in January, when we returned from 2 weeks away in Lincolnshire over Christmas to discover that messages had been sent out on the 11th of December for a consultation on major changes to the allotments, the closing date for which was about a week ago now. And we found there was a bit of a ferment going on in the allotments, because a few people had heard about this and were rather anxious about it. And so we then spent nearly two solid days getting ourselves acquainted with the facts and reading 45 pages of documents proposing widespread changes to fees and to the rules which govern allotments. And what was pretty maddening, I can tell you, when we went through this, was to discover that the version date on the document sent round to us was not even the 11th of December when this was sent out. It was the 11th of July last year. So this set of rules, which it's now widespread knowledge, all the Bristol allotment community is up in arms over, which they seem hell-bent on forcing through, has been written since 11th of July last year. And none of us, tenants or site reps who will necessarily be involved in implementing these rules, and it's implicit will be tied into enforcing them to some degree, had been involved in it. So it's no wonder it's a mess. So when I stand back now and look at what has happened, it's evident that the main problems with the new proposals are that there are really startling rises to allotment fees. And one can accept that some rises need to occur. There's been a lot of inflation and there hasn't been a rise in the allotment fees since 2018. Though one might say that one might wonder what the allotment office, or rather the council, have been doing in not organising serial small rises that people can accommodate during that period. So there are startling rises which, given that more allotments are in the poorer parts of Bristol, these will fall disproportionately upon less wealthy people. And you'd think that it was one of the things that Marvin would be concerned about, but apparently not. After startling rises, I would say the next biggest thing is that there is a suffocating bureaucracy in this new set of rules. And one of the things that's been absolutely wonderful about the allotment community over the years is its informality. It is a very relaxed and friendly atmosphere. And because many people go there because they feel depressed or stressed, and they get relief from it in visiting their allotment, then having a bureaucratic set of rules, don't do this and you must do that, and you've got to measure 18 inches here, and that sort of environment doesn't sit well.
If I can just chip in, because I can remember when I was working full-time here in Bristol back in around about the early noughties, a very stressful job editing, and on a Thursday, a Friday, I could only really survive the day if I knew I was getting out of the city. There is something about city life, I think, which is quite oppressive, and we do need to reconnect with nature somehow. And so what you're saying about suddenly sort of surrounding this with this bureaucracy is a way of actually taking away so much of what is valuable about using an allotment. But on a contrary side, let me put this to you, that you're getting a lot of produce off that allotment. And if I was a private landowner, I'd be saying, well, hang on, they're making X amount of valuable vegetables and fruit out of this, and we should be charging them commensurately. So you're getting stuff from your allotment much cheaper than if you were to go to a supermarket, aren't you?
I have to say I haven't really examined the economics of this closely, and I would say that we lose a lot as well as growing a lot. We eat a lot of food that would be regarded as substandard were it to be presented in a supermarket, and that's part of avoiding food waste.
We also share a lot of our produce with other people.
And I think, yes, one could say...
They're taking a commercial view. Okay, the council is not supposed to be a business, but they brought a lot of business people in as council officers, and they've got this kind of business mentality now, and they're looking at this as a cost centre. Look, we need to make some money here. They're also thinking in the backs of their minds, we've got quite a big waiting list of people ready to go on there. There may be people here who, if we up the charges, they will leave. But the new people who want an allotment will pay those charges. So it's a kind of business decision, really.
Oh, yes. I think you're right about the motivations. The council is short of money and they're looking to raise it wherever they can, and they see this as an opportunity in that respect. But I think I would say I'm more concerned with the equity of what their plans are, and especially the timescale with which this is being forced through. So, for instance, had they, when they wrote their rules document in July of last year, opened a discussion with us, which didn't have such terrifying timescales to reach a resolution over, I am quite sure that we, with the practical knowledge we have in managing allotments, could work a scheme through with them which would meet their aims. We recognise that prices need to rise over time, and the allotment service itself needs money too to be able to provide the functions it gives to allotment sites. And there are various ideas that we could introduce which might make things more equitable. But we've had no time for that. The gun's against our heads.
What's your sense of what the Green Party's attitude to this is? Because it looks as if they may well take over the running of the City Council in May and will be charged with implementing this.
Go on.
I think they are perturbed and disturbed by the manner in which this consultation has been carried out. And I think they specifically disagree with many of the proposals in the documentation. For example, many allotments have established trees and mature fruit trees, and we've been told, well, we must chop down our trees and we must keep trees to a height of 2.5 metres. Now, this is ignoring and, in fact, in contradistinction to the Council's very own rules on net zero and acknowledging the climate and ecological emergency, because allotments have a hugely important role in supporting biodiversity. And there's been a lot of research done on that. For instance, Professor Jane Memmott at Bristol University is a professor of ecology and a pollination expert, and her research has found that allotments are extremely important, perhaps the most important of all places, given our nature-depleted countryside, in harbouring wildlife and especially pollinators.
What about mental and physical health? This is something that, I mean, I'm a bit overweight. I'm not ashamed to say it. But if I was out on an allotment, I would be actually, it would be good for my physical health. Mm. Isn't this surely something that should be being encouraged? Because, I mean, I'm putting the business case to you just a minute ago, Stephen. Actually, a city council is not a business. It should not behave like a business. It should be the custodian of the city for the voters, for the residents. And surely, I mean, there is an argument to say that actually maybe people shouldn't have to pay anything for an allotment if they're prepared to look after it and to actually grow food to add to the city's food supply, then they should be given that for free.
I'm not sure I'd agree
entirely. You need to administer it, but we're paying our council tax for that sort of thing.
Indeed. I think Julie's given a good outline of why allotments are valuable for biodiversity, and it's important to mention in that context that allotments are now recognised as one of the most diverse hotspots that there are because of the variety of plants and flowers which are grown there to support pollinators and wildlife. And where we take land everywhere to build our houses on and put gravel driveways and astroturf our front gardens, we need allotments to have spaces where wildlife can live. Now, wildlife is an important part of the council's priorities. So are green lungs, oxygen for the air which comes from the trees, the cooling effect of trees which are on many allotments, the removal of dust from the air that leaves tree leaves provide. Those are things
soil
which
stabilisation.
Yes, these are things which are important for the council. But the things which upset me particularly is that many of the things which Mayor Rees bangs on about as being important, such as mental and physical health, are absolutely vital components of what goes on at allotments. There was one rather stroppy individual who used to come to our site. He's moved out of Bristol now, and he and I had a pretty spiky relationship to start with. And it wasn't until a little time had passed that I realised that he got so riled up in his job as a teacher that he needed to come and bash his anger out in the allotment after work in order to become a calm and sane man again. And he was absolutely lovely once he'd done that. But it was clear that it made an enormous difference to his mental health. We, as site reps, until Marvin Rees chopped the funding and closed Chandos House, which was the last residential rehab place for alcoholics and drug addicts in Bristol, made an arrangement with Chandos House for people who were recovering from drug and alcohol addictions to come to the site to work together. And for these men, they were mostly men, that was incredibly valuable as a part of their rehabilitation, in a sense, back into the community and normal life. So that's mental health. Physical health. I'm a GP, it shouldn't need me to tell you that the activity that goes on in allotments contributes towards the 150 minutes per week of gentle activity that we are all recommended to do as part of maintaining good health and keeping ourselves out of the doctor's surgeries. So that's a priority of Mayor Rees as well. And yet he's got it into his head that allotment sites are little gardens for the well-off and the bourgeois to go and grow a few upmarket vegetables. And what he fails to realise is that allotments deliver the priorities that he has. Let's mention education next. We have a junior school close to us, the Westbury Park Junior School. And some time ago, Catherine was the deputy director of it. And we got together and organised a plot on the site for the children of Westbury Park Juniors. The parents got involved in knocking the allotment into shape. One of the teachers acted as liaison to connect it to the school, and the kids would come down, they would get their hands dirty and learn about worms and growing peas, the sorts of things that you love to pick fresh, and they could begin to learn about the carbon cycle of life and death, in which when things die, they break down in the compost heap, and this week's rotten tomato becomes next year's potato from the same atoms just reconstituted. And that's an absolute miracle that many city children do not understand because they don't have exposure to this. And so this aspect of education, as well as the social opportunities for these kids in working collaboratively together in digging something, learning to take turns in using the tools, there is so much that people can learn from this. And I think it's important that the city recognises the jewel it has in its allotments. And at the moment, it's failing to, or at least Bristol City Council is failing to.
Well, they may well argue, Stephen, that actually, because of all the people that they've got waiting for new allotments, even if people decide they can't afford to do this anymore, they don't like the bureaucracy, those plots will be filled from the waiting list.
Well, you might be right. So let's just run that supposition for a moment. Let's say you're right, and by raising the prices enormously, it drives a lot of people off the allotments. Well, what may come in after that is a lot of new people who can easily afford them. And what Marvin will have done by this device is to have selected the most wealthy to have allotment plots and ruled out the least wealthy. Now, is this the sort of project he's got in mind? Is this his real aim? I very much doubt it, but if that's the effect, then it's not a good thing.
Well, you might say that's the reality today. Local government, since 2008 bailouts, local government has got to be raising its income from somewhere.
Yeah, I accept that the rents do need to rise, and I think that the Bristol allotment community recognises that too. I think the point is that there needs to be equity, and there needs to be an equalities impact assessment, which is a technical term for an evaluation of the relative effect upon poorer and wealthier people of changes which are proposed by government. And the Bristol City Council have promised one, but they failed to deliver it so far, and they're asking for the decision to be made before it's available. It's all arse about face.
So we just heard about the school next door. You have a relationship with not just those as your neighbours. You have other neighbours that you've got relationships with, don't you? On your site?
Well, yes, we do. For example, we have a bowling club near us, and they deliver their grass cuttings to us. Now, that would be a disposal problem for them, but we're happy to take their grass cuttings because we put it into our compost heap to biodegrade, or we use it as mulch, or we have various uses for it. That's a very fruitful relationship. We've got relationships with local tree surgeons who likewise, when they cut down people's trees, they've got a lot of wood chippings that they've got to take somewhere and dispose of. Instead, they can bring them to us, and you wouldn't believe how quickly they go because they're very, very much sought after on allotments for a variety of different purposes.
So what purposes? What can you use wood chippings for?
Oh, well, you use it for paths to suppress weeds.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
You can use it as a mulch. Under fruit bushes, again with the same purpose of suppressing weeds, and ultimately it will rot down and provide nutrition in the soil, which the worms will take into the soil. You can also make them into what are known as hibernacula, which is a posh word for a place that you make that a slow worm, for example, might be able to hibernate in by mixing in leaves, wood chip and sticks. It provides warm places for slow worms and other creatures to hibernate in over the winter.
Might I mention a couple of other things we've had from time to time, connections with cafe or restaurants to take coffee grounds. Again, a disposal problem for someone else, but perfect for rotting down and using in the allotments.
Yes.
I should say also that on our site, this isn't the case for all allotment sites, we have a community orchard. And I think I want to mention community groups in connection with this consultation, because they are one of the essential parts of a civilised society that are going to be seriously damaged by the proposals as they currently stand. So across Bristol, and the example in our allotments is this community orchard, which is five plots on the allotment site,
which these stem from the days when half of the site was derelict, and a very enterprising German man was able to take over these five plots because of the condition of the entire site and turn them into the community orchard that it is now.
So there are now a lot of mature fruit trees of all sorts, together with ponds and other things which are useful to biodiversity. And it's worked by a self-organising group of people. I think there are 35 or thereabouts involved in ours now, who come and work with each other to prune, manage this orchard and to share the fruit, organising apple pressings, for example, and some make cider. Now, this social activity brings people from different walks of life together. It's a community activity in which volunteers work together to give something back. It's connected to neighbours, to families, to us as allotmenters. They have a compost loo, which they make available to other tenants on the site. So it's an incredibly cohering part of the community. And there are many similar, differently organised. Everything is according to what's available locally. There are many different community groups across Bristol doing growing projects such as this, which allow people for little expense at the moment to participate in a community activity and to share food. Now, the rules, when they're changed, will, for instance, regard any assembly of more than 12 people together on an allotment site as an event. Moreover, it's an event has to have permission obtained from the council, and an event is chargeable. So when, for instance, Julie and I organise a communal clear-up on our site, we do this seldom now because the site's now in pretty good order, but we did quite a few of those when we first started, where lots of people gather together and tidy up the allotment and collect litter. We're going to have to get permission to do that, and we're going to be charged for the privilege.
Martin, this is sounding to me, this idea of gatherings of more than 12, a little bit like something like the Criminal Justice Act, where the idea is that you know, there may be unlawful assemblies going on Bristol's allotments.
Well, I'm struggling to understand the logic behind this that the council is
money raising.
I think it is money, and of course, the big picture is that many local authorities in Britain are bankrupt as we speak. Birmingham's bank, for example, is bankrupt. Liverpool's in special
measures.
Yeah, the
Daily Mirror on Monday this week published 25, they think, local authorities around the country are on the verge of bankruptcy.
That's right.
Coming into the new financial year this April.
The whole weight of austerity was landed on local authorities, and that was a political decision by the central government, because, of course, it means that Labour Mayor Marvin Rees has to do the nasty stuff, and they can say, look at terrible Marvin Rees and what he's doing.
Yes.
Of course, he also has got a responsibility to explain to people what's underlying all of this. But I think something like this is actually rather symbolic, because we have got an election coming up in May, all of the issues of the positive aspects of allotments you've laid out very clearly, and it's going to be an issue in the election, as it should be. Yeah. And I think that, you know, but the problem is when the Greens do take over the councils, I suspect they will, they're going to have exactly the same problem with no money that the existing council has got.
Well, one of the things that Guy Portney, a Green councillor who was on here a couple of weeks ago, was saying, he said what he was disappointed with these proposals is that the council actually has a lot of land around the city, little bits of land. He was saying, well, actually what we'd like to see is some of these lands be opening new allotments. That's a good way to deal, he was suggesting, with the backlog and the waiting list.
Yes. I don't know details, so I hesitate in being too didactic about this, but it is also my understanding that there is there is land that could be used for allotments, which is currently underused. What I don't know is what the management or financial implications of that are, but it certainly warrants investigation. And that's the sort of thing also which, to come back to the timescale and the ludicrous timescale that's being pushed, had this been approached in a more open and consultative way, then the many ideas, and I can tell you that the allotment community in Bristol is a very fertile place from which to generate novel ideas, could have done a lot of investigative and development work.
Yeah, this would have been so much better as a bottom-up change. This is not. It's a top-down change.
Well, it's mystifying.
KPMG or something.
Well, we are told that some of the changes that are in this new tenancy rules document were the results of suggestions made by site reps. But, well, if that's the case, you know, I don't know what they are. We were never consulted. And I simply cannot understand why it was that our expertise as growers and as managers of sites around the city was not harnessed to help the council in the development of these new rules. It's just mystifying.
Well, to me, it's about a culture of money, not a culture of people. That's the difference, and it's something that we see so much in the world today, that some of the decisions that are being made seem to be just simply financial decisions rather than seeing people as a resource to galvanise their support behind something. Exactly. You might well find you don't have to pay a penny if everybody's behind it. Anyway, look, we started talking about the whole sort of consultation process and procedure, the timeline. Can you just tell us where we're heading now? Now and when there's going to be some sort of final implementation of this, if it takes place?
Yes. Where things are now is that the period for public opinions and comments to be made closed yesterday. According to the council's website, there should now be a period of review and analysis before the final results. This is what you can find on Ask Bristol, which is the way the council interacts with the public and consults. So one might expect, and we know that there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of comments put in during this consultation process, that you might expect that there's going to be a lot of work done to sift through this, work out what the main themes are, in order to decide what to do about it. That's to say, if this was a proper consultation.
Is there an alternative? Because there's a lot of elderly people that maybe just don't have the internet or don't use it. You know? Is there a paper version?
There is. One can submit on paper, but Tony, I don't want to be diverted by that just for the moment, because you would think that that's what would be happening. Detailed analysis and formulation of new proposals would be going on in the council.
Maybe a bit of weeding.
But what is going to happen, we understand, unless it's pulled at the last minute, is that there's going to be a meeting after this weekend on Monday. So this is 4 working days after the consultation closes. In fact, it's slightly less than 4 working days. And there are said to be 40 expert growers invited to this meeting on Monday.
Are you as site reps, have you been invited?
Well, we have been invited and we've been told that the priority list is going to be drawn up, which will favour site reps. But as yet, and it's now Friday evening, I have had no confirmation that either I or Julie will be permitted to attend. And because we have been vocal in pointing out the difficulties with the proposals and the process yeah. that's been going on, it's a process failure that's gone on here. And to a significant degree, Ellie King as councillor is complicit in this because she's not taken an action to change it for the better. So there's been a process failure here, and it is not certain that we will be permitted to give our expertise to this meeting. But step back a moment and ask, well, what can a meeting on Monday achieve when the public consultation has just closed? It's inconceivable they could have redrafted the documents over the weekend. And even if they had done so, then they wouldn't be able to give those of us who attend them to look at beforehand. And these are big documents, remember. So therefore, I can see only two possibilities for what might happen at this meeting on Monday. Number one is that they hand out the same documents and say, give us some comments on them. To which I would say, isn't that what the consultation that's just been running for 6 weeks is about? We've been giving you our comments. This is a pointless duplication exercise. So, no point. The second and more sinister possibility is that they may ask us to rewrite the document on the hoof. There are 40 people. Let's take six groups of six people, each given six pages. Go and write a document and give us it better. Now, if that happens, then that will completely sidestep the consultation. Yes, it will produce a document at the end of the day that's better than the current one, but it completely subverts the public consultation that's been going on and ignores the views of everyone who has poured love and effort into this. And I've seen in your hand, Tony, the submission by Thingwall Park Allotments, which is one of the biggest sites in Bristol, who consulted. They have 300 tenants. They consulted 60 of them who came to a meeting, and the site rep there has condensed that into a brilliant summary of the themes and detailed problems and proposals for approval. In fact, just the sort of job the council should have been doing had it started this last year. And all that will be wasted if in this meeting on Monday, the people who managed to get into the room are asked to redraft the document. So it seems a pointless exercise, a damaging exercise, in fact, because it will reduce trust through handling it in this way. And what's more, it's directly contrary to what Ellie King, the councillor, promised to the Allotments Forum on the 24th of January, when, during what was rather a turbulent meeting, and many allotment plot holders expressed very strong views, and a motion was carried 50-3, saying that the forum, the Allotments Forum for Bristol, regarded the consultation as a failed one, a process failure. Ellie King agreed to a proposal, in fact it was me who made it, that this meeting on Monday be postponed until they had had time to do a proper job of redrafting the documents based upon the consultation comments received. That's the obvious way to do this correctly. And by not doing this, Ellie King and the Bristol City Council are really failing the people of Bristol.
Well, not only that, many allotmenteers will be thinking, what is the point of meeting with these people where when ways forward are agreed at those meetings, then they're then ignored?
Well, it is very disappointing, yes. And I mean, I have to say that there are, I know of many other site reps across Bristol, and we're gradually getting together with an email group and WhatsApp groups to talk to each other in a way which hasn't happened before. I've learnt from many of them that they're not going to go to Monday's meeting because they think it's completely pointless for the reasons I've given. And that's a bit upsetting, really, because these are intelligent people who could be making the good suggestions.
Well, not only that, you know, you're giving your time for free.
Well, yes, it's not just that, but
I think that's there is something sort of almost mentally damaging about that. When you, it's almost like a kind of abusive relationship. Hang on, we're donating our time to sort out these allotments to make sure that everything is working nicely, and in return, we're being told we were agreeing something and then we've been told, actually, no, we've changed our mind behind your back.
Yeah. Well, you're right, it is upsetting, but it is upsetting, but I don't want to dwell on that.
No, it's true that site reps save the council hundreds of thousands of pounds a year by doing work on a voluntary basis that the council would otherwise have to pay for. So we're responsible for assigning plots to tenants or prospective tenants on the waiting list when plots become vacant. Now, if we weren't doing that, the council would have to do it themselves. It's simply not viable that the service could run without the contribution of site reps. And yet we're not treated with the courtesy and the respect of involving us in matters about which we have become expert.
I suppose maybe better to term it as a kind of bad employer rather than abusive relationship. So I noticed, by the way, it's not just the growers here in Bristol that are having trouble, because last night there was a meeting of Welsh farmers over the border from right over the whole in Welshpool, which is in sort of mid Wales, which is looking at a big farmers' lobby in the whole of Wales, very critical of the Welsh government's attitude, particularly to livestock farming. And although there is this sort of campaign now to say, well, actually, livestock farming isn't the best, the fact of the matter is, we have also going on the continental Europe this week, enormous protests, particularly in France, a blockading of Paris, doing things like ripping up railway lines to stop trains getting in and out of Paris, because they, in a way, the farmers are saying, look, if you're going to treat us like this, you're going to starve. This is their, seems to be their attitude. Obviously, that's not the case for allotment holders, but there seems to be a wider problem, actually. It's not just about Bristol's allotments. It's about the way that we ensure that the food system operates. If we go back far enough, actually, you'll find the first civilizations grew up once farming and food production was organized. And it seems that there's almost a, I don't know if either of you want to answer this as an awkward question, but almost a kind of counter move against people growing their own food.
Well, it's very short-sighted, and for sure, farming is an absolutely vital contributor, regardless of its economic component. Sometimes people, you'll hear politicians say that the farming lobby can be dismissed because it's not a big contributor to the economy in the way that, for instance, the City of London is. But, as you say, when there's no food in the shops or on the table, then things will get pretty dicey. And we have a big and increasing population in Britain. We already are well short of our sustainability in our food growing capacity. We're forced to import. And farming has the ability to be both damaging if it's heavily industrialised, or beneficial. And it's now, science is now realizing that there are many aspects of traditional low-intensity farming methods which are fantastically valuable to modern civilizations, such as, for instance, flood control. Just to give one example, people are only waking up to that just recently, such as pollination.
Carbon, the soil being a great store of carbon.
Yes, for bogs and in varieties of habitats. And you were talking earlier about failures, or asking earlier, Tony, about failures on the allotments. Well, one of the failures does occur with pollination. And if we mess around with the climate sufficiently that the bees don't know when to come out in spring, and they come out on one warm, sunny day in late January, and then they die because it's freezing for the few following days, then what happens is the plants don't get pollinated, and we are already noticing in our 20 years of allotmenting that growing is a bit more dicey than it used to be.
If a particular plot wants to introduce bee colonies or a colony of bees, there's probably an extra charge for that, is there?
Oh, there is.
Yes, there is.
There is, yes. And in my mention of community groups earlier on, orchards, community orchards and community growing groups like this, which democratise food growing by involving a lot of people in it, they're to be charged £400, I believe, as an upfront fee for being able to set up such an arrangement. And, of course, that sort of thing just is going to stifle them out of existence. Not entirely, but largely it will.
So what have you got to say, Julie, to listeners who actually may be allotmenteers themselves, maybe thinking of having an allotment? Is it just going to be too awkward to do that in Bristol? Where do you think this is heading?
Well, it's difficult to say. It's clear that the current administration, which is in its last months, is determined to push this through before it leaves. If it does, I think there's going to be considerable turmoil. If, as you say, if the Greens are... when we return to the committee system, and the Greens have said that they will be... that their decision-makers will be meeting in groups that represent all the political parties proportionately, then we don't know what agreements they'll be able to come up to.
I mean, you see, you're a site rep yourself. Will you be in a few months' time walking around the site every week with a clipboard saying this person's going to be fined for this, putting fines on people's plots?
No, I don't wish to be treated in that
way. Because that's what the council's saying, is the site reps are going to be implemented.
I didn't sign up to that. And it has to be remembered that allotments are social environments just as much as they're growing environments. And I don't wish to be complicit in enforcement of things that I don't agree with. We don't know where this is going to head because we're at the point of a changing administration.
Yeah, I agree completely. And the thing is, this is managerial incompetence and fear in the council. You mentioned it earlier on that it's all about money, but I think it's more than that. The handling of this process has been extremely badly done, and one of the drivers for that is that there are many in the council who depend upon volunteer work to get things done that they have no money for, seem to treat the people who can help them get things done as part of the problem rather than part of the solution. And that climate of fear in the council is, I'm quite sure, what led them to keep the document that they wrote on the 11th of July last year from our site until the consultation began at the beginning of December.
When people's minds were on Christmas, not on consultations.
And so you ask what will happen. I think, and how would we advise people interested in allotments? I would say get your names on the waiting list. If you're not on a waiting list, you can't possibly get a plot. You can always decide not to take it up later on. There is a chance that things will turn out for the better. There are indications that many of the rules which they've proposed will be dropped, and that's a sign of how badly this has been handled, because the roughness and the immaturity of these documents should have been ironed out before they came out to public consultation. And if that had happened, there would be far less heat in the debate. That's a significant part of the problem, and it's a managerial failing.
Yeah, well, it's actually a managerial technique, bouncing people into things by leaving them far too little time.
But it's also unnecessary. If you involve stakeholders in process when there are changes afoot, you secure their cooperation, and instead you've what has happened is that a great deal of confrontation has been caused, and this is entirely unnecessary and unwarranted. And it's not rocket science. There are much, much better ways of going about the management of change. We've known that for many years. It's widely practiced in Scandinavian countries, and it's an utter failure that we don't do it in this country.
So have you got a sort of a site for Bristol allotmenters? I think there is a Facebook, but I mean, I don't really see Facebook as a proper website. Do you have a website?
For Bristol allotmenters?
For Bristol
general,
allotments
or site
and
reps.
For the campaign, I suppose.
Oh, well, for people who are wanting to be involved, then I think probably Bristol Allotments Resist is the group to go looking for. You can Google and find, and there's a very active WhatsApp discussion group, a number of them in fact, there, so you can find out information in that way. I am trying to bring together the site representatives across Bristol, and if there are any site reps who happen to be listening who as yet have not joined up to the group that connects us, I would strongly encourage you to do that, because it is only a good thing that we talk to each other, In doing so, we will normalise our opinions so that the more extreme will move towards the centre, and it will then enable us to form a collective view on things, and that can be very powerful.
Yes, and there's a WhatsApp group, and for those who are not on WhatsApp, there's a Google group that you can join.
Fantastic. Well, look, Stephen and Julie, thanks ever so much for joining us. The idea that they have to make money and that this is a managerial failure, I think it needs to be sort of re-emphasised in spades, if I'm allowed to say that. We've had £100 million or so spent on the Bristol Beacon, an enormous overspend part of that as well. We had something like £40 million poured down the drain on Bristol Energy. We've just had, and we're going to we go on to another topic now, £5.5 million has been spent on the totally unnecessary evacuation of Barton House. And to cap it all, Max Walsh at ITV West this week has exposed that the council knew that they were going to have to evacuate people if they didn't do anything a year ago.
It's been revealed Bristol City Council knew the Barton House tower block had structural issues more than a year before 250 residents were told they had to urgently leave their home.
It's been nearly 3 months since residents were suddenly evacuated from their homes, after engineers warned this tower block could collapse if there was a single flat fire. The council has repeatedly said residents' safety is the top priority. But tonight it's emerged structural issues were flagged here more than a year earlier. In response to a public question, the council wrote, "We commissioned a structural survey of Barton House and this report was received in August 2022. This report flagged structural issues at Barton House. Bristol officers determined the risks presented could be mitigated. Yet in November 2023, this report was peer-reviewed by Engineers Arup, which significantly escalated the structural risks and led to the evacuation."
Well, it's a bit shocking to know that they know for a long time and then take the chance to leave people in the building till last minute. So that's a lot of chance and a lot of life they played with. And to me, that means they don't care and didn't care.
It didn't have to be this way. They knew about it in August 2022 and took no action, it seems like, until November 2023. They could have spent all of that time preparing, getting residents ready. Other evacuations of blocks, like the Ledbury Estate in London, which is similar in some ways, they took a long time to do the evacuation. They offered rehousing for people who don't want to move back. All of those options are available if you plan ahead, but the Bristol City Council's just not done that planning.
So that's Max Walsh's report on ITV this week. Martin, so... You know, looking at this allotment thing, we just heard from Julie Parks and Stephen Pill there, husband and wife, allotment reps in Redland here in Bristol. This is just another mass incompetence. Now, it seems that a lot of the time that the Bristol City Council's leader, Marvin Rees, and the leadership team are keeping things from the public because they know if the public see them, they're going to go nuts. In this case, what's happened is... August last year, the year before last, it was in November that they decided they had to evacuate, but they knew that they were going to have to evacuate for a year beforehand and did nothing about it. This is just, it almost seems beyond incompetence.
Well, I mean, obviously, I listen to all of these, things that we're finding out about various aspects of what the council has or hasn't done, and, you obviously, when people get things wrong, they've got to be criticised. Clearly, they got it wrong in this case, because if you knew a year ago, why does it take a year to get round to doing what you're supposed to do?
Charging the because they're incompetent and they're playing at being council leaders. I think that's what's going on here. Barton House family's flat was left in a terrible mess. Now, they've been paying rent for this flat, and yet the people that came in to do the surveys while the place was evacuated have left their flat in a terrible mess. It obviously wasn't fit to live in if their flat has been used to do these surveys in, things stripped off the wall and their possessions piled up in the corner, and they're being expected to pay rent for this.
Well, I think, as I've said before about this, it seems extraordinary that you evict people and then expect them to pay rent for a facility that they're no longer using. Presumably somebody should be held accountable, presumably officers, for getting all of this wrong.
One of the things that's, ITV, I'll put a link up to their report, Barton House evacuation structural issues were flagged to Bristol City Council in 2022, over a year before the actual evacuation. None of the people involved in this decision not to do anything back in August 2022 or the decision in November 23, with the 400 people were just evacuated. Now they're starting to trickle back. None of the actual specific council officers involved, even at the senior level, have been even named.
Well, it may be that, you know, there are specific people who are responsible, but it may also be that you've got churn going on with people coming in and other people leaving. And that's, and things just not being done because there's constant change of personnel. It's hard to know if we don't get any specific detail, isn't it?
It certainly is. Now, just another kind of, well, it's not really local. I suppose I like to think of King Charles as local, since he's got his pad at Highgrove, just up the road near Tetbury here, not very far away, as we said a few weeks ago with Matt Williams, from the Caution Bunker. As Camilla's house and Princess Anne and King Charles's house were all very close to the Caution Regional Seat of Government nuclear bunker, where they could jump in their cars and be there within about 20 minutes if they needed to be. So that's worth noting. But anyway, Charles has been accused of abusing his position to force his views on the nation. I have running problems with this man, King Charles. First of all, his involvement with Sunak in appointing Cameron to become the Foreign Secretary, the guy who was one of the patrons of the illegal Jewish settlements fund, who conducted the execution, or was involved in that anyway, of Colonel Gaddafi, the overthrowing of the Libyan government and the turning of that country into a total basket case, which then starts shoving thousands and thousands of migrants across the Mediterranean into Europe. So this is Mr. David Cameron for us. But anyway, King Charles is also quite clearly somebody that knows a lot more than he says about the death of his ex-wife, Princess Diana, with Noel Botham and John Morgan's books on the topic being, I think, should be on any sensible person's bookshelf. But anyway, Charles has been shown here now to be abusing his position in I think it's Novara Media have done this video. And here's a little clip from it now about the King and how he abuses his position to force his views on the nation.
The issue isn't just that Charles believes bizarre things, which he really, really does. It's that he's repeatedly used his position to force his beliefs on the public. Edzard Ernst was professor of complementary medicine at Exeter University, an academic physician. He was interested in the possibility that complementary medicine might actually work. And so he subjected various treatments to rigorous trials. That's when Prince Charles became interested.
When I came to Exeter, I noticed with delight that Prince Charles took an interest in what I was doing. He even asked for a copy of my inaugural lecture, and I was delighted because I thought he was going to support me. But Prince Charles has a bee under his bonnet about alternative medicine, and he thinks that the NHS should pay for it. But the NHS should pay for what is evidence-based, not for what Prince Charles happens to like. And I think we should investigate it properly.
Ernst devised trials to test the efficacy of various homeopathic and herbal treatments. But on every trial, the alternative remedies failed. Charles wasn't satisfied with those results, though. He tasked economist Sir Christopher Smallwood with writing a report advocating for the use of alternative medicines on the NHS, despite knowing that the trials had failed. The report was published in 2005, and it was funded by this woman, Shirley Porter. She was the Tory leader of Westminster Council, who oversaw a racist and classist Homes for Votes scheme in the council, which won the Tories a decisive victory in 1990. When the story broke years later, Porter was stripped of her damehood and left the UK in disgrace. Ernst gave an interview to The Times to express his anxiety about the content of the report. The consequences for him were grave.
In this interview with The Times, I said that I fear that he's overstepping his mark in terms of what he's supposed to be doing as heir to the throne. On the same day, I got an email from Christopher Smallwood that he would make sure that I would regret that. an official complaint from Charles's office reached my Vice Chancellor, and my Vice Chancellor started 13 months investigation into my dealings in this affair. At the end of this, I was pronounced innocent, but all support at Exeter broke down, contracts were discontinued, and eventually I had to go into early retirement. He doesn't seem to tolerate anybody who has the slightest difference in opinion to his own.
Over the years, Charles has lobbied the government repeatedly over his often fringe hobbies. In 2006, he took the Daily Mail to court after they published some extracts from his journal. And during the case, his former spin doctor submitted this witness statement. The prince used all the means of communication at his disposal, including meetings with ministers and others, speeches and correspondence with leaders in all walks of life and politicians. He was never party political, but to argue that he was not political was difficult. These letters were not merely routine and non-controversial, but written at times in extreme terms, containing his views on political matters and individual politicians at home and abroad and on international issues. He often referred to himself as a, quote, dissident working against the prevailing political consensus. I remember on many occasions seeing in these letters, which, for example, denounced the elected leaders of other countries in extreme terms and other such highly politically sensitive correspondence. It took The Guardian 10 years of legal wrangling to get hold of those letters. They included advice about which helicopter the army should be using and a recommendation of a badger call. But they also contained a request to Tony Blair to delay implementing an EU law restricting the sale of herbal medicines. Paul Richards was advisor to the Blair government in the years that the letters were written. He spoke to Channel 4 after their publication.
Well, certainly the letters that I saw lobbying on behalf of so-called alternative medicines, homeopathy and so on, well, around about that time, £1 million was given to Charles's Foundation for Homeopathy and Alternative Medicines. Another letter I saw invited a minister to come and visit his architectural experiments at Poundbury, and a space was found in the diary within minutes for the minister to go and visit. So, yes, you have to argue that there is some influence being brought to bear.
After the publication of those 27 letters, the Cameron government changed the law, making it almost impossible for any others to see the light of day. Why? Well, Dominic Grieve was Attorney General at the time. He tried to block the publication of the 27 Black Spider memos, writing this: "The sovereign cannot be seen to favour one political party above another or to engage in political controversy. Any such perception would be seriously damaging to his role as future monarch, because if he forfeits his position of political neutrality as heir to the throne, he cannot easily recover it when he is king."
So that's Novara Media there, giving us a bit of an idea. I think, in a way, the worst thing involved in that, Martin, was all this stuff about homeopathy. Now, I mean, homeopathy, to me, is like the crazy end of alternative medicine. There's lots and lots of stuff out there, particularly natural remedies, which are very sensible and may well work much, much better than some of these pharmaceutical industry chemicals. But the idea that that King Charles has invited this guy who is an expert to do a report about homeopathy and design a real good test to see if it works or not, and he doesn't like the result, and then he's treating him in an extremely appalling manner, because he you get the idea, the guy's a control freak.
Well, there are two things to pick up on here. One is his views, whether it's about homeopathy or other things, and the other is his role as, you know, a monarch in a constitutional monarchy. Historically, British kings have always had their views. I mean, a lot of the history of Britain is the King's Party versus, you know, the Country Party or whatever. So in many ways, what Charles is doing is exactly what, you know, George III or Queen Victoria did before him. And, gradually the monarch's powers have been reduced, but there's always been a row about it. It's always been an issue, and it's still an issue today, as it was in the 18th century.
Well, I think it's more of an issue now with Charles, because he's getting a very much... He's extremely more politicised, isn't he, than Elizabeth. He's getting involved in massive changes through the World Economic Forum and through the implementation of these carbon credit system, the zero carbon agenda.
Yes, and of course the contrast is with his mother, who very rarely commented on political matters. But people got used to the idea of the Queen, Queen Elizabeth II, being very reticent to comment on things. And of course the fact that her son is much more forthright is a change in that sense. But I think if you look at the longer historical perspective, you know, kings being problematic in this way is actually a problem, which is why, of course, the Americans got rid of having a king in the 1770s because of exactly this kind of issue.
Oh, and it's so much better.
We don't want a king, thank you. It's so much better there now,
isn't it? I
mean, if you've got
a deep state, I'm afraid they're just going to appoint whoever they want.
Well, exactly.
In a way, a hereditary monarchy can get in the way of appointing you. Sometimes these hereditary systems throw up someone that actually gives a damn. But anyway, we're not going to agree on that. You've got your Republican views.
And then
I'm a monarchist. I'm quite a fan of Charles I, for example, Charles II, Charles III. No. Yeah, anyway, we're joined on the line now, moving on to by Steve Headley. At least I hope we are. Steve, are you there? Can you hear us?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Steve, I know you're a former leader of the RMT Union, the Rail Workers Union. Can you just tell us a bit about those days and give everyone a bit of a background on your work there?
Okay, so I was I was firstly a regional organizer and then the senior assistant general secretary of that union for about 15 years. And during that time, we were involved in some very heavy industrial disputes and over pay conditions and over the rule of the guard was probably the longest running one. We'd seen people taking sometimes 30 or 40 days of action to defend the rule of the guard and to defend safety on the railways.
This week, though, you know, we'll talk about your book in a minute before we say goodbye, but you've had a pretty fascinating week, haven't you?
Yes, we've...
Can you just tell us where you were working, what sort of teaching work you were doing?
Yes, I was teaching in the in a college called New City College London at Havering, which is quite near Upminster. And I've been going in there for 3.5 weeks. I was told I was on a long-term contract. And I'd just come back from Ireland where we'd commemorated the 52nd anniversary of the Bloody Sunday Massacre. And I had a little badge in the shape of Ireland with the Palestinian colours on it, because obviously we very much sympathise with what the Palestinians and what they've endured for 75 years and what they're enduring now, which in my opinion is a genocide.
Well, you say it's obvious. It's not obvious to everybody that any kind of links and similarities between the Irish struggles and the struggles of the Palestinians. Can you just explain the link?
Well, Ireland's been under occupation for 800 years, over 800 years. And during that time, Irish people were ethnically cleansed. At one time, out of 3/4 of the country, Cromwell said you had to go to hell or Connacht, so you had to die or go to one province, which was Connacht. And that reminds me very much of what's happening in Gaza now. And we had right up the 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 1847, the famine, which wasn't really a famine, which thousands of tons of food were shipped out of the country while Irish people starved to death. And that was a sort of a genocide of Irish people. And Irish people have resisted ever since. We've resisted colonial settlers. And that is very much what the people of Gaza are doing, the people of Palestine are doing. They're resisting colonial settlers. And they're being... The colonial settlers are trying to perform a genocide on them. And I think what oppressed people recognize oppression when it's happening elsewhere, and that's why Ireland are in Palestine,
especially if it's perpetrated by the British. Although David Cameron is trying to sort of wash his hands, and we'll be hearing from him in a little while of all of this, the British created America, the British created the State of Israel actually it was the United Nations, but the British troops were the ones who were in a position to influence that, because they controlled all that territory between the First and the Second World Wars. And so the British were and of course we implemented the Balfour Declaration, which was about the idea of the Zionists creating their own state in Israel. So the Brits are very much involved in both Ireland and in Israel, Steve, aren't they?
Yes, and indeed Balfour was involved in Ireland as well. Balfour was, well, Balfour deliberately designed Israel around what happened in Ulster. Ulster was the most rebellious province in Ireland, so they brought settlers over there from Scotland and England and put them in Ulster and basically drove the native Irish off their land, which is exactly what happened in Palestine 1947, 1948, after the war. Settlers came from all over Europe and drove the Palestinians off their lands.
Well, I think you put a pretty good case as to why it's okay to wear the badge that you wore to work, but what happened?
Well, I wore the badge for 3.5 weeks with no troubles, and at the same time, people were walking around with poppies, which commemorates the British Army, who had carried out the massacre in my hometown. And they were also walking around with Ukrainian flags. Now, I didn't object to that at all. I thought, you know, live and let live. But then somebody said, my boss, in fact, said, can you take that Palestinian flag off, that Palestinian badge off? And I explained to him why I was wearing it, the parallels with Ireland, the fact that I'd just been back, the fact that he was wearing a poppy, and he didn't see a problem with that.
So was this an incident back in November?
No, this was a few days ago.
Oh, right.
But So the whole school is decked out in Ukrainian colours. They have collections for Ukraine going on. And obviously I very much sympathise with anybody who's in a war side situation. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but I just want to see the same standards applied to people in Palestine. And I can't help but think, is it because Palestinians are brown and Ukrainians are white that Ukrainians are getting the sympathy and the Palestinians aren't?
Martin, Martin, can you just chip in here?
Well, under what regulation? I mean, as you say, if people are wearing poppies and Ukrainian flags, and of course in the US it's de rigueur for all politicians to wear an American flag in their lapel and all the rest of it, surely in a publicly funded education facility, people can express their views by wearing badges. But under what regulation were you told that you have to take this badge on?
Well, they didn't seem to have anything written down, but they just decided that this was offensive in whatever way, and told me I had to remove it or go home. And I pointed out exactly what you just said, the fact that all these other political badges were on display. In fact, mine was a humanitarian badge. I was just campaigning for a ceasefire.
Yep.
And basically, I was told to go home and that I was no longer required there, and basically sacked over the fact that I wore a Palestinian badge. We went back the next day and we leafleted the school, and the children immediately drew the parallel. They immediately drew the parallel because they said, look, there's Ukrainian badges all over the school. There's Ukrainian flags all over the school. Is it because the Palestinians are brown? And these were black kids and Asian kids, not all of them Muslim by any stretch of the imagination. Some of the white kids were also getting what was going on. And this is the irony of it. We were just teaching about McCarthyism in the United States in one of the film lessons that I was doing, one of the film classes, performing arts classes that I was doing, just covering McCarthyism, where people with different political views, that they were socialists, were driven out of work and blacklisted and didn't get work for years, sometimes imprisoned. And then the school instigates a policy like this, with anybody with a Palestinian badge is thrown out of the school and denied work and blacklisted. It couldn't have been more ironic in a way.
And when you say it's a school, I mean, is it like further education college, something like that?
Yes, it's a sixth form college.
Sixth form, yeah.
You know, they're not really kids, they're young adults from 16 to 18.
Yeah.
Yeah, Steve, can you name some of the individuals who've made this decision?
Well, I don't want to do that, but it was the principal of the school. It was the HR in the school. I don't want to name individuals because the fact of the matter is that it's the school policy, apparently. And we have to combat this. Unfortunately, you see, this isn't an isolated incident. A lot of schools and further education establishments are banning anything to do with Palestine. So we have to be beware of this slide into authoritarianism and into McCarthyism. We had it at the start of the invasion with the Ukraine. Everything, I remember they were cancelling the Russian ballets and stuff like that, you know. I hardly think that that the ballet dancers were some sort of KGB agents. Maybe people have been watching too many movies, I don't know. But this sort of mania against Russia, and now we have this kind of mania against Palestine. But at least you could have said that Russia and Ukraine were fighting some sort of equal struggle. What Israel is doing in Palestine is genocide. They're fighting a lightly armed militia who, you know, backed by Yemen, who Yemenis and the Palestinians are the bravest people in the world as far as I'm concerned. But they're massively outgunned, massively outnumbered, and the West, including Britain, are providing not only arms and equipment to them, but flying drones over Gaza at the minute and helping in the extermination of the Palestinian people. So we as a country, we have to stand up, because I'm not accepting the argument for anybody that they're just following orders or they're just doing their job. That's how genocides happen, and we have to stop that.
We certainly do. And this week, just to add insult to injury, I think we saw on last week's programme on Friday, we were discussing the attacks on the UNRWA centre, the Palestinian Aid Agency of the United Nations Centre, where 20 Palestinians were shot dead, including several of the aid workers, by the Israeli the brave Israeli Defence Forces, killing these people who are dishing out essential aid like food and water to those people. And whilst we were live, we discussed this amazing event, which was the accusation that the aid agency had several people who were involved in Hamas, the 7th of October attacks by Hamas. And so what's happened is something like 20 now, mostly NATO countries, led by Britain and the United States, have actually withdrawn funding for Palestinian aid. So this came at the same time as the International Court of Justice judgment in The Hague against Israel by the South Africans, that the South Africans have brought. So it seems now we've moved from just being a fight between Hamas and Israel to massive, like, wickedness, really, at the top. So not only are they saying, well, we don't care what the International Court of Justice say, Steve, we're also going to cut off any aid and actually double down on the genocide, just try and starve and obviously kill with bullets those Palestinian people.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolute dystopia. I have to tell you, Tony, the first 2 weeks of this thing, I couldn't actually believe it. I was watching Al Jazeera, because you actually get a bit of truth in Al Jazeera because they're on the ground out there.
Yeah, it can be a bit wearing watching Al Jazeera. It's almost like horrific attack, atrocity after atrocity. Yeah. The sort of thing that you might expect in a horror film, and there it is on the news every hour.
Yeah. And I had to stop watching it after 6 o'clock in the evening, because I just wasn't sleeping at night. And I talked to many, many people, and they were in exactly the same boat. And we were just saying, you know, I never understood actually how genocides happened in the past. I didn't understand it. And I can't remember who the person was, but he said, yes, there are monsters in the world, but they're too few to have much effect. It's the people that just go about their normal business in these times and carry out the orders of the monsters that are a real problem. The unquestioning automatons who walk along and carry out the orders and expel people from schools from wearing badges and shut down debate and do it because they're afraid to lose their position. They're the real problem. And I have to say to those people, you need to wake up, because if they can kill Palestinian children today, they can kill your children tomorrow.
That's a very, very important point, that if these sorts of atrocities are not nipped in the bud, you might say, then, of course, the perpetrators, who are themselves criminals, will gain support, they'll gain finance, and they will gain more and more momentum behind what they're doing. They will take the weakness of the international judicial system, the United Nations, etc., as a pat on the back. So, but not only are those things I was talking about just now, you know, with UNRWA and the aid being cut off to Palestinians who so desperately, desperately need it, and I think, you know, we need to almost bring this to a level, a sort of human level, where you've now got, you know, mothers and fathers
who are unable to protect their children, those children looking into the eyes of their parents and crying, you know, that this situation is there are millions of Gazans in that situation now. That's what genocide looks like. That's what it looked the attacks on the Jews were like, and the Gypsies and the trade unionists in Nazi Germany were like. But this week we had an accusation by the Israeli government that John Irvine, who's an ITV reporter who was over in Gaza, last week, I think it was on Thursday, he filmed a guy with a white flag trying to go and reach some people who had been isolated. Is an old Palestinian chap, and he had a white flag with a group of people, and as he's waving it and going towards the, he's shot and killed by the Israeli Defense Force. John Irvine and ITN filmed the lot. Obviously, the most horrific scenes were edited out, but because they'd edited some of the horrible scenes out of that, the Israelis accused them of editing it in the wrong order to mislead the viewers. So let's have a little listen to that report. So I think it's quite important that we understand the extent to which the Israelis will go in order to attempt to, you know, to take away these basic war crimes that are being caught in. If they don't kill the journalists, when the journalists actually do film these war crimes taking place in front of our eyes, they're called liars.
This is the edge of the supposedly safe area called Al-Mawasi that the Israelis have been encouraging Gazan civilians to flee to. These makeshift homes have been vacated because the war is getting closer. The billowing smoke was evidence of the new Israeli offensive in Khan Yunus that has been forcing more families to evacuate and seek safety elsewhere.
No place safety in Gaza. Everywhere you are going, you will find the Israeli army. They are shoot us at home, any building, in the street, everywhere you are. They will give you a chance, sometimes just for 5 minutes, sometimes do not give you any chance to take your clothes, to take your children, to take your family and to get out of the building. This is our life in Gaza. It's very difficult.
These pictures were filmed by a cameraman working for ITV News in Gaza. As he moved forwards towards the combat zone, he noticed this group of men doing their utmost to appear non-threatening, trying to proceed with care. They wanted to reach two other family members and get them out of harm's way. The interview complete, our cameraman walked away. And then this happened. The interviewee had been shot and fatally wounded. You can see them place their flag on his chest. As he was carried away, the white flag was turning red. Carry him. They've killed him, yells this youth. Then suddenly, more gunfire. They scream at a child, telling him to find cover. By this stage, the man's wife, his widow, has heard what happened. And as she rushes to the scene, she meets the party carrying away the body on a makeshift stretcher. When they're satisfied they're a safe distance away, they stop. And the mourning starts. These tragic scenes have been repeated time and time again since this war began. At one point, they tried CPR, but there was no bringing him back, this husband and father. Yet another innocent Palestinian civilian killed while posing no threat whatsoever. John Irvine, News at 10, Tel Aviv.
So even when that's put on the ITN News, Martin, the Israelis say, oh, yeah, but you just misedited it on purpose to make it look like we killed him.
Well, they've got a huge propaganda campaign orchestrated, haven't they? You're talking to our colleague here who's been removed from his job. And of
Steve,
course,
yeah.
Steve, and David Miller has been removed as sociology professor at Bristol University here by the Israeli lobby. He's still pursuing an employment tribunal over that. And the Israelis have always massively invested in propaganda, and they've got huge troll factories with people paid money to go online and push certain tropes into the social media sphere, and they're so busy at it, they constantly make stuff up, like the 40 dead babies that have been beheaded, and of course that is subsequently shown to be nonsense, and nothing like that had actually happened, even though Biden said he'd seen photographs of it. But of course this has its effect. That's why they do it. It has a sort of stupefying effect on the public, where they think that they've heard both sides of the argument, and therefore there's six of one and half a dozen of the other, but of course that's just not the case.
Well, Steve talked about the connection between the Irish struggle and the Palestinian struggle just now, and I would just refer people, if you haven't already watched it, you might have to correct me with my name pronunciation here, Steve, but the Irish lawyer Blin Ni Gralech at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, working for the South African government, accusing Israel of genocide in Gaza back on the 11th of January in that court case. Is that the correct pronunciation? I bet it's not, is it?
Oh, I don't think it is. I don't actually know how that's
pronounced. All right, well, yeah, okay, because it's an Irish name. But the point is that that was possibly the most devastating presentation of evidence by the Irish in the UN court in The Hague of the fact that this most definitely is a genocide. Steve, I hate to have to ask you this, but where do you think this is all going in Palestine? It's obviously a cause that's very close to your heart.
You know what? I really don't know. I'm just hoping some of the Arab countries intervene and stop this absolute massacre and genocide. I hope. I know most of the Arab countries are intimidated or bought off by the West, or a bit of both, and are frightened of America.
Well, I think, to be honest with you, one of the reasons that they're not intervening is because they see this as an Israeli trap. The Israelis actually do want to widen the war.
Well, I mean, I don't know, because I think one thing that this war has showed is that Israel is in a tenuous position. I mean, we have a settler population, and if the United States pulls the plug, that's it, they're finished. The Israeli economy will tank within probably six months, because if they're not getting the billions of dollars from the United States and the weapons from the United States, so that is a possibility. But I mean, what else is going to happen? Or how many Palestinians does it take to die to provoke a reaction? I think if the Arab leaders don't do something, the Arab masses might do something. And I can't barely watch the TV sometimes now. I can't bear to see the suffering of the Palestinians. It's beyond comprehension.
I mean, Martin, one would have hoped, wouldn't they, that that the Egyptians would have opened the border just to let these people out from under the bombs.
Well, don't forget that the Israelis have sealed the border, and of course the Egyptians also don't want to let them out, because then, of course, the Israelis will say, well, they can all go to live in Sinai, and we'll put them in camps in Sinai. And of course, they've approached the Egyptians because...
Wait, surely that's better than being bombed to death.
Yeah, but the point is you've then done the Israelis' job for them of ethnically cleansing Palestine. What could happen, and what did happen in the past, is that the Egyptian army goes to war with the Israeli army. And they're big enough and strong
enough.
Egyptian army under Sisi is not going to be doing that,
is it?
That's right, because the previous Muslim Brotherhood government under Morsi possibly might have done that. But of course, it's not a democracy in Egypt; it's a pro-Western dictatorship.
And all the people that supported,
they're not going to do that.
All the people that supported Morsi, most of them were actually arrested and executed.
That's right.
After the Muslim Brotherhood,
he himself died in prison. Yeah.
Anyway, Lord Cameron, our wonderful Foreign Secretary, brought in by Rishi Sunak and King Charles on the day after Remembrance Sunday, like they can't remember anything about avoiding future wars. Lord Cameron, he had this to say this morning about the possibility of Britain recognising Palestine, if there's anything of it left.
We've always said is we believe in a two-state solution, a secure Israel within its borders and a secure and stable Palestine within its borders. Britain, along with other countries, would recognise Palestine as a country and recognise Palestine at the United Nations. And what I'm saying is, of course, that can't come at the start of the process, but it doesn't have to be the very end of the process. It could be something that we consider as this process, as this advance to a solution becomes more real. What we need to do is give the Palestinian people a horizon towards a better future, the future of having a state of their own, because I think that is absolutely vital for the long-term peace and security of the region.
Well, I think that's what he's saying there is absolutely being contradicted blatantly by Netanyahu, who says there's never going to be a Palestinian state. And, of course, the right wing, who are in control of Israel at the moment, they're pretty solidly, you know, quite a lot of the population do support this genocide. So, you know, there's no, democracy is not going to solve the problem.
I think it's around about 80% of the Israeli public do.
But, I mean, the point is that the Palestinians don't get a vote in that, so it doesn't mean anything much from their point of view. But of course, they've made it clear that there isn't going to be a Palestinian state, and Netanyahu says from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan Valley, it's going to be all Israel. That's what we're going for. Now, in that situation, the West could just say, well, in that case, we're going to de-recognize Israel. I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia during the 1990s, and we went to war with Serbia because they wouldn't disgorge Kosovo. We put in a no-fly zone, and then we bombed them, just as we did in Libya. Now, why aren't the Western powers doing that with the Israelis? I mean, this is a clear case of genocide. You could put in a no-fly zone tomorrow. They could fly from Akrotiri, the RAF, and stop the Israelis using air power, which is exactly what we did in Libya. Even though the Libyans hadn't, in fact, used any air power against the rebels, and the whole thing had been concocted in advance by the French and the British to overthrow Gaddafi. The rest of the world can see all of this. They can see the hypocrisy of it all.
And also the propaganda. Before we get off of the subject of Palestine, we will come to your book in a minute and talk a bit about the changes this week that have been with the Northern Ireland Assembly, Steve. But last week's listeners will have heard the uproar at the end of BBC Question Time, which was being filmed in Gillingham last Thursday, where somebody started heckling, and the question was, ironically, was all about young people. How do we make a brighter future and hope for our young people? Well, of course, there were no young people on the panel, but there was one young woman in the audience who lives in Gillingham and is a supporter of Palestine. And so she started shouting out. She started heckling Fiona Bruce, saying, well, how can young people have a future while genocide's going on? Why aren't you talking about all these thousands of children that are being killed? We want a future without genocide. This sort of thing, she was shouting. And Fiona Bruce just tried to brush this under the carpet, pretend she was talking about something else. Oh, nobody can hear you. Why don't you just shut up? So it's interesting, isn't it, that you've got a panel of whatever it is, five or six people up the front of Question Time, plus their production team sitting up in the gallery, and they don't want to actually listen to what young people have got to say about how do we have hope for our young people. So this week they did, actually, funnily enough. She successfully bounced Question Time into discussing Gaza this week, and they had a very good discussion. I think it was up in Glasgow, this week's one, and I had to sort of toss up between either playing you some of this week's discussion. I think what I'll do is I'll just put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But it turns out the lady heckling last week's name is Claudia Bolin from Gillingham, who's part of a local Palestine solidarity group. And she's a Christian. She sings in her local church. And she's got this to say about what happened with Question Time last week. So it'll be interesting to get your comments on how what is the real future for our young people, Steve, after we've heard from Claudia.
the two questions that I submitted, I personally have like a lot of anger and pain about the situation, but I wanted to amplify Palestinian voices. My questions were written by a wonderful Palestinian woman who's part of our solidarity group, and she thought of the questions. They have to be 25 words long, and she wanted to know about would these politicians commit to a Palestinian state and what the terms of that would be. And she also wanted to ask about freedom of speech and how we can protect anti-Zionist voices, because at the moment it seems that these people are being smeared as being anti-Semitic for opposing the idea of Zionism and the crimes that Israel are currently committing. For example, if you look at what's happened with Mohammed Al-Kurd, so he is a writer from Occupied Jerusalem. I've followed him for quite a while. He's incredibly articulate. I'm going to put some links to his stuff in the description box because you really need to follow him. Anyway, he was asked to speak at one of the London marches and he misspoke. And there were pressure from people to try and get him talked to by the police, like counter-terrorism people, and it really was ridiculous. Whether or not you agree with this man, the reason that he was investigated was literally for misspeaking. And it's a waste of our money, it's a waste of police time, and it's basically a way to intimidate people who are going to talk about the crimes of Israel and basically the ideology of Zionism. This push to connect Jewishness and Zionism is incredibly dangerous.
So that's Claudia Bolin. Yeah, I'll put the full clip of her. She's got her own YouTube channel, which you can find quite easily. Steve, what do you make of young people like that? So you've got Fiona Bruce from Antiques Roadshow. I don't know how she managed to get that job, but she stood in the middle of this flagship current affairs program where they're supposed to be discussing all the big issues of the day. Several months they haven't discussed Gaza. This week, thank God they do. But it looks as if it was Claudia there, we just heard from, last week by heckling, that forced the production team to actually get this question onto Question Time.
Well, I think it's basically about the control of the media, isn't it? The states in this country have got absolute control of the media. I mean, if anybody has seen the absolute farce where in the International Court of Justice they gave the showed the Israeli rebuttal of the South African argument, but not the South African argument itself. Mm. I mean, that doesn't make sense in anybody's mind, no matter which side of the debate you may happen to be on. How can you have a rebuttal without you hearing the case? It's clearly nonsensical. And this is what's happening. We're being controlled. We're being drip-fed. And all I can say to people is you've got digital TV now and you've got the internet, so look at other sources. Don't rely on the BBC. The BBC is a government-funded organization. People like Bruce are put there because they are gatekeepers. They will stop the truth getting out when it's not in the interest of the British government and the British state. That's what they're there for.
Okay, before we talk about the just a general state of the trade unions at the moment, which I'd like to wind up with you, Steve, there's also this issue of the Northern Ireland Assembly coming back together. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, look, I think the Northern Ireland Assembly is part of Stormont. It's part of British rule in Ireland. And I think that's it's been a kind of a con that's been foisted on Republicans and nationalists, if you like, in the north of Ireland. And I think it guarantees to an extent the union is veto. In Ireland, where the demographics have already shifted, you've probably got more nationalists and Republicans now in the north than you have got unionists. And we've had this bizarre situation where the DUP took its ball home for Democratic Unionist Party, took its ball home for nearly 2 years. It still got paid, by the way, still got paid when they weren't working, and refused to go to work over a Brexit deal, which they campaigned for, you know.
This week we had on How to Win an Election, which is a Times Radio podcast on a Tuesday morning. We had the great Peter Mandelson giving us his thoughts about what's going on with the Northern Ireland Assembly, and particularly to do with the slow crawl towards Irish unity in a potential vote. So he seems to be, to me, one of those people involved with those in the City of London who sit and actually manage Britain, almost like a sort of executive committee behind the scenes, a kind of P2 of the UK. And he does betray quite a lot here in that he is most definitely an insider in this process. So let's have a listen to Mandelson talking about Northern Ireland unity this week.
Peter, I just want to ask you, with your as a former Northern Ireland secretary, a big moment that the Northern Ireland Assembly is coming back, but it's a huge moment that it means the First Minister is going to be from Sinn Féin.
Oh, I think this is going to be a landmark development in Northern Ireland's history. I mean, first of all, you know, thank goodness the DUP, led by Geoffrey Donaldson, have seen sense and he's shown some bravery. Also, all credit to Chris Heaton-Harris, by the way, the Secretary of State, who has shown considerable patience and skill in getting the party to this point. But yes, it means that for the first time ever, an Irish Republican, Michelle O'Neill, will become the First Minister in Northern Ireland. I think she will conduct herself well and sensitively in that role, and so too she might, because, you know, this is still fragile. But here's another point as well. During the course of the coming year, you're going to see an election in the Irish Republic, where I think Sinn Féin, the Republicans, are leading in the polls or very near, with along with Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. If the Sinn Féin play their cards right in Northern Ireland, and it does them credit and status, and they look as if they're, you know, behaving in a responsible way, this will broaden their appeal, other things being equal, in the Irish Republic, and you could see them topping the poll in the Irish general election in the coming year. That, too, would be an amazing landmark development.
And does that then lead to a poll on unification?
No, not necessarily. That would depend on where the public go on both sides of the border. If the British government concludes from a consistent pattern of opinion polls that there seems to be an emerging majority in Northern Ireland for a border poll to take place, then they would be obliged to undertake one, but it wouldn't just be in the north, it would be in the south as well.
But do you think that's the direction we're heading in?
Not necessarily, but I think the DUP, and I think the cause of unionism, have done themselves quite a lot of damage by holding out against the assembly elections over the last 2 years.
Can I ask you a question? If there was this is an open question, not sort of angled, but I if there was to be a border poll of that kind, would the Labour government take a stance on whether or not there should be, that Northern Ireland should remain inside the Union? Because our official position as a country is that we'd have no selfish strategic interest in the Union. So, with Northern Ireland. So, where would Labour go on it?
That would be the same. They would not campaign, they would not lean either way. Both parties have accepted, on the basis of the original Belfast Good Friday agreement, that should a border poll, two border polls, take place, north and south, then the British government would stand back and allow the public to have their say.
Secret leader of the Labour Party, Lord Mandelson, also obviously a member of the UK's Executive Committee Propaganda Lodge. That is Peter Mandelson. Steve, what do you make of what he's got to say there about the prospects for a united Ireland?
Well, you see, I kind of agree with him in a way. I hate to say it, but I think that the prospect of a united Ireland is no longer a threat to Britain, because Sinn Féin are no longer a socialist party, and are no longer really a Republican Party in the true sense of the word. I think they want the capitalist 32-county Ireland, and I don't think that's going to be a threat to anyone. And in fact, it'll save the British a lot of money, because they won't have to prop up the economy in the north. So I think it's probably strategically handy for Britain to withdraw. And as soon as they can do that without sort of plunging the place into any kind of strife, I think they will. And I honestly do think that. But the way they've gone about it, and the way that the Republicans have kind of been hoodwinked into Stormont and all it entails, I think a better policy could have been done. And by the way, I'm totally for peace. I'm for building unity amongst working class people, Catholic, Protestant, and dissenter. And totally for peace. But I think peace has to come on the terms of class politics, not on the terms of changing the flag over Dublin Castle or changing the flag over Stormont.
No, fantastic. Well, look, Martin, what do you make of it? Also, particularly this whole idea that they're going to be two separate referenda and that the British government is not going to take any position. I mean, Madison seems to be very much on the inside of this.
Well, what was interesting, when the DUP had their boycott of the over the last 2 years, from their point of view, they've failed to understand, as Steve has pointed out, that Republicans never really wanted Stormont. That the existence of Stormont at all, and the acceptance of the existence of Stormont by the Republican mainstream, is in fact a huge concession. And
by sticking with it, they've done rather well, haven't they?
Well, let me just finish. I think the Republican position was that if we're not going to have Stormont, we're not that bothered, because what will happen is, as we become the government of the Irish Republic in a coalition, we will talk directly to the British government about what's going to happen in Northern Ireland, and the Loyalists don't get a say at all. And I think they've realised that if they don't go back into Stormont, they won't get a say. And they are, as Steve points out, becoming the minority even within the six counties. I take the point about class politics and all the rest of it. I'm still reasonably happy with what's happened. I'm personally relaxed about the Loyalists having a veto, because if they're gonna there will ultimately be a United Ireland, but it's got to be done in a way which makes everybody accept it without further
okay,
bloodshed.
Give us Steve and Martin. There will be a United Ireland at some point. Steve, you first, then Martin. Can you give us your guesstimate date, years?
I think it's going to be within a decade. I think the demographics will make it inevitable within a decade. You're probably going to have a Sinn Féin government north and a Sinn Féin government south within a decade, just because the other parties are so blatantly corrupt and people want something new.
Martin?
Well, yeah. I think that's probably right, but I do take your point that if Sinn Féin does end up running Ireland, even in coalition, they're going to face all of the problems that everybody faces in a global capitalist crisis where the economy, you know, I mean, one of the things in Ireland, of course, is the very low tax rates on corporations, which allows, you know, the Irish Republic to kind of keep its head above water, but is very damaging to other parts of Britain, for example. You know, like Jacob Rees-Mogg moved his hedge fund basis of his hedge fund to Dublin to avoid taxes.
So penultimate item before we say goodbye to Steve is there was a big rally actually in Cheltenham here. Nice to see one outside of London. Well done, Trade Union Congress. Yeah. Last Saturday in Cheltenham, and it was all about the right to strike. Well, before we hear from Steve on this, let's have a listen to Sharon Bale from Unite the Union, who was speaking at the rally at the end of the march.
I am really delighted to introduce Sharon Graham. Place where 40 years ago 14 trade unionists took on a government lie that being a member of a trade union was a threat to national security. And as we fast forward 40 years, we have the same brand of government weaponizing strikes, attacking workers, and trying to force us to send striking workers over their own picket line. Will I say to the government today, you are the real threat to national security. You are the real threat. You have crippled our industries. You have stopped us owning our own energy. You have handed our water into the hands of profiteers. And your latest act of industrial vandalism has been seen now in the steel industry that you are watching being decimated. Our brave men and women right now in Port Talbot, and some of them are in front here with us today. These brave men and women are fighting for 3,000 jobs, and they're fighting to keep steel production in the UK. Friends, let's send a message to every single striking worker. We are with you! Solidarity! Now, friends, make no mistake. Make no mistake. This legislation puts this government at war with workers. But they will not break our working class resolve. We will fight them and they will lose. Because remember, friends, remember, we will remember the key lesson. We will remember the key lesson from that attack on trade unionists 40 years ago. That if you stand on the sidelines and you do nothing, when the first target falls, it will only be a matter of time before they come for you. So when that time comes, we must be prepared to act ourselves, each and every one of us, because that's what real solidarity means. Friends in Unite, we have already been preparing. We have removed the requirement to act inside the law from our rulebook. And as it was said in 1921, it is better to break the law than break the law. And friends, we have paid £32 million in strike pay over the last 2 years. We cannot allow striking workers to be starved back to work. And of course, we are planning with other unions to use every single tactic in our armoury to push employers back who use this legislation. And make no mistake, any employer who uses this legislation and serves a work notice on any union, this will be seen as a hostile act. We will fight against you, we will escalate, and we will win. And friends, as for Labour, this legislation must be removed. Not in the first 100 days, but in the first day of a Labour government. The workers' right to strike is a fundamental human right. It's democracy and it must be protected. Friends, the flame flickers anew. The real power of the trade union movement is in places like this, with our reps, with our members, with workers. So let us build that great fire of collectivism. That's the power. That's the power they really fear. We are the vanguard. Let's lift up our heads as well as our banners. The trade union movement is reborn. See you on the picket line. Solidarity!
Okay, so that's finished rather abruptly. So that was Sharon Bale from Unite the Union.
Sharon Graham, surely.
Graham. Okay, sorry. Well, I mean, it was a bit of a distorted loudspeaker, so that's the name I got down. But I'm sure you can absolutely right to correct it. I've also got some audio also from Dave Prentice and from Mick Lynch, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Both excellent. Dave Prentice from ASLEF, Mick Lynch from ERMT. On our show page. But Steve, what do you make of this assault on trade union rights? It was actually, they're great fun, these big trade union rallies. Several hundred people turn up, some pretty feisty speeches. Obviously they're all, you know, slightly sometimes I wish there'd be a little bit more humour in them. And in fact, I think it was may actually have been Dave that did include quite a lot of joking about the Cheltenham races as well. But the point is that there is an attempt here to stop strikes by forcing workers to go to work, isn't there?
Yeah, and it's an absolute appalling. It's the taking away of human rights. But look, I'm going to shamelessly plug my book here, Dairy Boy, which is an analysis at the end, basically, of trade union bureaucracy. And we have these speeches, they speak to tens of thousands of people in Trafalgar Square about how they're supporting Palestine. The reality is Sharon Graham has got members making technology and weapons for Israel to carry out the genocide in Palestine. So has the leader of the GMB. Mick Lynch has got members serving in the Red Sea, enforcing a blockade of Palestine, attacking one of the poorest countries, one of the only countries to come to Palestinians' aid. In Yemen. So we've got Lynch and Graham and the other guy, I don't even know, Kenny, is it? I don't even know who it is from the GMB anymore. Up there making speeches, saying how wonderful they are by supporting Palestine.
But Steve, they are representing their members, surely. They're representing their members, and their members' interest is in their jobs.
Well, so it's okay then that they're just doing their job. I've heard that somewhere before. They're just following orders. So we carry out genocide, we just follow orders. Is that what we're saying? So people in Nazi Germany, would they have just said, we're just following orders, that's okay then. We'll just go and kill people. It's in our interest, because if we don't, we lose our jobs. Yeah. What a ridiculous argument.
Well, no, you're right, of course. So your book is called Derry Boy. What's it about? Yeah. Where can people get it?
Well, basically, it's about growing up in Derry and my first memories, which were Bloody Sunday, the massacre on Bloody Sunday, the day my granny, who never swore, swore at the TV. Takes you through my childhood growing up in an occupied country where people were killed, where hunger strikes happened, coming over to England, getting involved in the trade union movement and anti-fascism in England, becoming a socialist, a very left-wing socialist, revolutionary socialist, and ending up leaving the Labour Party after Jeremy Corbyn got thrown out of the Labour Party, and also getting basically thrown out of the RMT when the entire leadership, including Mick Lynch, Eddie Dempsey, and Alex Gordon, crossed the picket line of someone they had sacked. So, I don't want to dispel people's illusions, but people need to understand they have to be their own saviours, they have to be their own organisers. People have to go out there and organise within our movement, because a trade union bureaucracy will not put its privileges at risk. It will not risk losing their inflated salaries and their expense accounts and the finances of the union by breaking the law.
Well, so I think it's the same here at Bristol City Council. You do, you know, sometimes cliques do develop, don't they?
Yep.
Anyway, Steve, thanks ever so much for joining us. I'm going to finish with this clip from 2000. It's a programme called The Day to Day, and it's a look back at Margaret Thatcher's era in the 1980s and 90s, where the voices of Sinn Féin spokespeople had to be voiced over by somebody else. The voices, because there was this whole thing about the oxygen of publicity. We cannot give them the oxygen of publicity, even though, of course, they were a major political force in Northern Ireland, particularly that the British government and the BBC decided that we were not going to be allowed to hear their voices. So here's an old colleague of mine, bless him, Chris Morris, sending the whole thing up.
Sinn Féin have so far denied they are backing the campaign. Earlier today I spoke to their deputy leader, Rory O'Connor, who under broadcasting restrictions must inhale helium to subtract credibility from his statements.
So what's your initial statement?
These incidents are inevitable given the position of the British government.
You do support this campaign then?
The IRA have been forced into this position.
So you do support this campaign of violence?
The IRA... Sinn Féin is a legitimate political party.
Which supports terrorist action.
Your tone is antagonistic and you're making me very angry.
And since we conducted that interview, all sides in the conflict have had a meeting and have sorted everything out.
So that's Chris Morris from the Day to Day, and it's very much recommended as a DVD to put on the shelf alongside your Neil Botham and John Morgan Princess Diana assassination books. But anyway, I'm hoping now we're joined on the line by Peter Ford. Are you there, Peter?
I am indeed.
Peter, you're a former ambassador to Syria. You're also now part of this thing called the Workers' Party alongside George Galloway. So can you say something about this new role you've taken on?
Yes, well, I'm a long-time admirer of George Galloway, his track record of anti-imperialism is second to none, his championing of Palestine in particular has been brilliant over decades. He's been a man of principle, a renegade, parted company with the Labour Party, like me. I feel glad that I'm able to help him in a small way. And we will be launching George's campaign to be elected MP for Rochdale on Tuesday. That's breaking news. You're probably the first to air this news.
Okay. How does it feel to make the transition from diplomat to politician? I mean, you know, you potentially could be a candidate yourself now. You're certainly involved in the management of George's party.
Well, surprisingly little difference, Tony. I keep feeling that I'm back in my diplomatic harness. I still have to be careful what I say, because now it engages not just me, but also the leader of the party. So I have to keep a lock on my tongue. It's similar skill set needed. Diplomacy is essentially public relations, marketing. Then I was marketing Britain in the broadest sense, or the then government in a narrower sense. It was also dealing the job of diplomacy, dealing with politics. So they're very, very similar.
Now, there's been a statement today. The reason I asked you to come on, thank you for, you know, at such short notice doing that, Peter, it was announced, I think, first on the World Service. Western officials are for protest over the Israel-Gaza policy. More than 800 serving officials in the US and Europe have signed a statement warning that their own government's policies on the Israel-Gaza war could be grave violations of international law. They're calling it the Transatlantic Statement, a copy of which the BBC have, say their administration's risk being complicit of one of the worst human catastrophes of this century, but their expert advice has been sidelined. Now, I mean, I'm getting really deja vu here over the Iraq war, because there were clear bits of legal advice saying that this is illegal to actually pursue this war, but they went ahead anyway, didn't they?
Yes, but this time it's surfacing while the horrors are still going on, and the numbers are impressive. This cannot be just batted away by these governments or by Israel. And I see that the story is making headlines all over the world, especially in America. And Europe, as it should, and I think it's important because it takes the discourse about Gaza to a new level, at the moral level. So far, the warfare has been military, economic, informational, and legal, but now it's being taken onto the moral plane by government officials. This is something new, and I think it was sparked by the very commendable South African move to take the case to the International Court of Justice. I suspect that this is what has precipitated the crisis of conscience on the part of all these officials. So it's really quite important and very helpful.
Martin, this is the backdrop of this is, as Peter's saying there, is this judgment at the International Court of Justice last week. And there are many people, it seems, who are involved in the administration of our governments in Britain, the United States, and in Europe, who see this as it's a sort of small elite clique that have decided they want to do this, despite what the people and the actual nuts and bolts of government are telling them.
Well, obviously, the people that have signed this petition or whatever it is,
it's called the Transatlantic Statement, yeah, of 800 administrators.
I can imagine that people who are involved professionally in diplomacy and similar to Peter's previous incarnation, they are going to be seriously worried about the direction of travel here, because it looks as if the people in charge are simply not taking account of loads of factors that they ought to be taking into account. There's a real danger of this turning into a general war, general confrontation between East and West.
Can you say
North
why,
and South?
Though? Because I think many people are looking at the West, particularly Britain and the United States, and saying, why are they supporting this genocide? There doesn't seem to be anything in it for America. There doesn't seem to be anything in it for Britain.
Well, you could argue that it's the Israeli lobby in the US and Britain, which it clearly is. But it's also, don't forget...
What are Britain and America getting in return? If the Israeli Israelis are lobbying Britain and America, and I'll ask you this as well in a minute, Peter. If the Israel lobby in Britain and America is lobbying away, saying we want you to support us, what are Britain and America getting back out of it?
Well, I think what they're getting out of it is that underlying the deep state in the West is a desire to dominate in a unipolar world. They want the Israel, you know, things have been exposed now. In the first Gulf War, the Syrians and the Egyptians lined up in the desert to fight Saddam Hussein over Kuwait. Now, we see the Western powers basically supporting an imperialist settler state engaging in genocide. And, of course, this does open questions about British officials participating in that. They do open themselves up to be ultimately being prosecuted.
Peter, what's in it for Britain? What's in it for America?
Absolutely nothing for the countries, quite a lot for the politicians involved. What it is not is in the interests, the practical interests of the American people or the British people. On the contrary, every day that passes brings fresh evidence that it's working against the common interest. I mean, what's happening in the Red Sea in particular is damaging to economies across the world. And despite our own dear little prime minister denying that the action by the Houthis, the Yemenis, has anything to do with Gaza. I mean, does he really think we're that stupid? Despite his assertions and his being in a state of denial, very clearly it's prompted by Gaza and will stop the moment Gaza stops. So it's not about our interests. It's about political advantage in the case of America. No senior politician would dare stand against the Israeli lobby, especially in an election year. Everything else is just posturing and fabricating narratives. No, it's naked self-interest. If Joe Biden had taken the view after October 7, that he was going to distance himself from Israel, he would be dead man walking. You may think he's dead man walking already, but that's another debate. Politically, he reckons it gives him a chance to stay afloat because he's not upsetting, he's not getting the Israel lobby on his back as well as everything else. In the case of Britain, this is where it gets more insidious, not to say downright evil. I believe our government sees electoral advantage in stirring up Islamophobia in this country, in stirring up anti-Palestinian feeling, in stirring up the debate about anti-Semitism, because it all puts Labour in an awkward position. Labour themselves have impaled themselves on this pike up their backside. They can't allow any distance to develop between themselves and Sunak, or they get accused of anti-Semitism. But they're hemorrhaging support among Muslim communities in this country. The Tories also reckon that defence is one of their few remaining winning cards. Even voters who are hostile to them generally reckon they are a safer pair of hands. So this is deliberate politicking by the Tory government.
The BBC are saying, with regard to the transatlantic statement, that the voices of those who understand the region and the dynamics are not being listened to, said one official. What's really different here is that we're not failing to prevent something. We're actively complicit. That is fundamentally different from any other situation I can recall, added the official, who's 25 years national security experience in the US government. anonymously, speaking obviously, because otherwise they'd be sacked, no doubt. The statement signed by civil servants from the US, the EU and 11 European countries, UK, France and Germany, it says, Israel has shown no boundaries in its military operation, which has resulted in tens of thousands of preventable civilian deaths and the deliberate blocking of aid, putting thousands of civilians at risk of starvation and slow death. There is a plausible risk, they say, that our government policies are contributing to grave violations of international law, war crimes, and ethnic cleansing and genocide, they said. So Peter, can you remember anything where the crimes have been so obvious, it seems, and yet we're being told by the BBC we must have balance, we must give the Israeli point of view, relaying the Israeli arguments that saying that John Irvine, when he was reporting the killing and execution of an old chap wearing waving a white flag last week, the Israelis say you've edited that. So the idea is that you've got to have balance, you've got to have the Israeli side and then you've got to have the Gaza side, if you can find a journalist that's not already been killed in Gaza.
Well, I'm the last person who would defend the BBC, but I have to say the Israelis are not wrong in pointing the finger at the BBC. I've been agreeably surprised to see that overall the message that the BBC are conveying is biased, as it should be to anybody with an ounce of moral sense. And this, the fact that they've led with this story of the 800 officials speaks volumes in itself. This will not please the Israeli lobby. Yet again, the BBC will be accused of taking sides. So on this occasion, I have to be fair and say that the BBC, while still being very indulgent towards the Israelis, and we saw this on Question Time last week, when the presenter would not allow a Palestinian heckler to speak. But overall, I think the BBC, like all good liberals, can see the wood for the trees here, can see the moral dimension of what's happening, and this is reflected in their reporting.
The Murdoch empire, particularly Talk TV and The Times, has been particularly biased, perhaps because of the oil concessions at Genie Energy that Rupert Murdoch holds in the Golan Heights. Martin, we've got quite a bit of, I mean, even just day to day, we're getting more and more news. Gaza seems to be sort of falling off the headlines, even though there's some horrific stuff going on. Apparently today, just reading on antiwar.com, the Republican, Representative Mast is a Republican from Florida, is saying Palestinian babies are not innocent. We've also seen today Israel destroying a Belgian aid agency offices in Gaza. Palestinians demanding an international inquiry after a mass grave has been discovered, and the judges urging Biden to examine unflagging support for Israel. So in the background to all of this, I mean, just those are just headlines. You can comment on them if you want. But in the background to all of this is this strike against which has killed three US servicemen in Syria, am I right?
There's some dispute about whether they were in Jordan or in Syria. Yes. There's some dispute about it.
And the American reaction has been this bizarre kind of menacing. Basically, Biden is menacing Iran. He's saying, we've decided what we're going to do to you, Iran, but we're not telling you what it is.
Well, if we're going to pick up on that last bit, first of all, because, of course, the public opinion in Britain is pretty clearly opposed to what the Israelis are doing, which is why it's so strange that Starmer can't move his position when Sir Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, has come out in favour of a ceasefire. So, you know, there is some hope for some breakthroughs there as we come towards a general election. But if we're looking at the actual situation in Syria or in Jordan...
Well, it's the wider situation where Biden is now menacing Iran.
Well, I mean, they shouldn't be based in the Al Tanf base in Syria is illegal. They're not supposed to be there. The Syrian government don't want them to be there. The Jordanians,
aren't these Americans sitting there almost like bait, a little bit like the British warship HMS Diamond sitting in the Red Sea. The idea is we actually would like to expand this war. We want to make it much bigger, and we'll put a few of our servicemen there, and if you kill them, we can then extend the war.
Well, the question is, have they war gamed this through, and all the rest of it? But I mean, they shouldn't be there at all. And the same goes for the bases inside Iraq.
But we have to deal with the situation as it is, don't we?
Well, the situation as it is that the Iraqi government, the elected government of Iraq, and the elected government of Syria have said you need to leave. They've stayed. That means you cannot claim that if you're an illegal occupation of somebody else's country, they've got the right to kill your soldiers. They just have. And you haven't got the right to retaliate. Now, of course, this could lead to a general conflagration, which, of course, should be avoided. The US should simply leave the Middle East and let the Middle East sort out its own problems without them there. And the British should not be encouraging them to stay. The British should probably leave Akrotiri in Cyprus as well. The local people in Cyprus are furious that Akrotiri is being used to supply the weaponry to the genocide in Gaza.
OK, Peter, I wonder if you'd like to pick up on any of those headlines. I was saying that this Republican representative... saying that Palestinian babies are not innocent. Israel also destroying this Belgian aid agency office in Gaza. Palestinians demanding an international inquiry after a mass grave is discovered in Gaza. Amazing with all these headlines that this can fall off the news. Obviously today it's that we've had this statement, but a judge urging Biden to examine the unflagging support for Israel, questioning the whole thing. And in the background to all of this, we've got this menacing of Iran, actually, for a US serviceman being killed, as we've just heard, on the Syrian-Jordanian border.
Well, there's a lot to unpack.
Well, you pick up on whenever you like.
The Republican there is obviously out of touch, not just with morality, but public opinion in his own country. I just read an opinion poll published today indicating that over half of adult Americans think that Israel is going too far. But I've no doubt that Republican will be handsomely paid for what he said. Moving on to Iran. Well, Iran has got the Americans by the short and curlies, because those American soldiers there where the three borders converge of Syria, Iraq, and Jordan, they're sitting ducks. The only purpose they have is just that it would be awkward and embarrassing to pull them out. They have no military purpose there. They're officially still fighting ISIS. Well, good luck if you can still find any ISIS in that corner of Syria. No, they're there simply because it would be embarrassing to pull them out. And Iran fully realizes this and has been harassing several U.S. bases in the area. And now they've just upped the ante by actually killing American soldiers. So what's happening is that American soldiers are dying for the sake of Israeli settlers. That is how the situation has to be interpreted. They're not there to protect America. It would be far-fetched to claim that they were there to protect America. They're there and being attacked because of America's allegiance to Israel. That is how the discussion needs to be framed. And finally, let me point out that Sunak is playing a blinder for the Workers' Party by continuing to take his very pro-Israeli positions. He's really, really making things awkward for Labour, that can't allow any distance to develop from the Tories, otherwise they'd be accused of going back to their old Corbynite pro-Palestinian anti-Semitic positions. And as a result, the good people of Rochdale, where there is a sizable Asian minority, are very upset with Sunak and more importantly, with Starmer. And therefore, they are, we think, going to hemorrhage Labour votes to us, because we are the only party that is standing for with full support, not weasel words like the Liberal Democrats, full support for Palestine, and we condemn Israel.
Well, look, there's another outcome possibly there, Peter, and that is that you just take votes away from Labour and the Tories or the Lib Dems or someone else gets in.
Well, speaking personally, I'll be happy if we prevent a Labour win. But our aim is we're in it to win it. And I also will express a personal view that I really believe that George is the front runner.
Well, we shall see. Talking about killing US servicemen in the Middle East, I think it's worth going back to 1983 to revisit the Beirut barracks bombings, Martin. October the 23rd, 1983, truck bombs struck buildings in Beirut, housing American and French servicemen. The multinational force in Lebanon, mainly US Marines, were killed. 240 US and 58 French military personnel were killed. That's 307 in one big bang. Now, this is only three, and yet it seems the reaction is far bigger now than it was back then.
Well, the reaction to this latest attack...
It's worth saying, sorry, that the Americans pulled out in 83 as a result of this.
They did, although they then shelled the Lebanon indiscriminately from their ships out in the Mediterranean. The what's happened in this situation in Iraq, because it's the Iraqi paramilitaries which have claimed responsibility for this attack in Jordan or Syria, wherever it took place, because there's some dispute about that. But they've also said that they will stop attacking US forces inside Iraq, provided they commit to leaving. So I think there is some discussion going on behind the scenes about, you know, if you just go, we will stop killing you, which of course is the right solution.
So Peter, do you think the Americans will leave ultimately?
Yes, it's just a matter of time. I mean, scuttles are the American modus operandi. They scuttled out of Lebanon under pressure. They scuttled out of Afghanistan. And it's just a matter of time before they scuttle out of Syria and Iraq.
Well, Peter, thanks ever so much for joining us and for your insight there. I don't know if you'd like to just share with our listeners places on social media people can keep up with your work.
Well, I recommend that they just go to the Workers' Party of Britain website, where my own activities are highlighted alongside those of our leader, George Galloway.
What about Twitter?
The Workers' Party Twitter feed. I don't do a separate feed yet myself.
You're threatening to. All right, former ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, thank you very much for joining us. Martin, ultimately, people like Peter have worked in that world. His insight, I think, into the annoyance of these officials is very useful. But at the end of the day, what's going on slowly but surely is those in the UK who are behind this genocide, supporting this genocide, perpetrating, funding this genocide, are surely they're getting a bit more isolated by the day.
They are, and of course, what may happen is if it's like any kind of strategy game or game of chance or whatever. If you keep doubling down, then you risk losing everything. And the US basically have continuously made poor decisions from their own point of view, and they are absolutely defeatable. But of course, the tragedy is, I mean, all the death and destruction. It's quite clear that the Palestinian population supports Hamas's armed struggle against Israel. Latest opinion polls amongst them show that they are, that the more the Israelis kill civilians, the angrier the survivors become and the more determined they are to continue the fight.
There are something like 20, maybe as many as 20 Russian warships have been sunk by the Ukrainians. Another one this week, it's called the Ivanovets. This is a corvette, a guided missile corvette. This is happening, I mean, obviously it was a massive ship which was sunk in the dock in Crimea over Christmas. But the implication here in some of the coverage is that really the Ukrainians have absolutely no capability to do this without the help of NATO. They're one by one, they're sinking the Russian Black Sea Fleet.
Well, the Russians are very well aware that the Ukrainians couldn't do this on their own. They are, you know, the Russians are very well aware that they are fighting NATO. They know they are. Putin has said as much. And, of course, they've got an election coming up in March, so it's just 1 month away, the month of short month of February. And
50 sailors on that ship, by the way.
That's right. But, I mean, they're killed by... I mean, at some point, the Russians may decide... I mean, this is what... There's no discussion about war and peace in this country, but there should be. I mean, we have the head of the British Army saying, well, we're going to war with Russia, we need to mobilise everybody. And it's like, we need to listen to what these people are saying. We are already at war with Russia. And what ultimately may happen, if we go around killing Russian sailors and airmen and foot soldiers, they will kill ours. Ultimately, that's what will happen. If they strike back, they will strike hard. And they will go to kill as many as possible. And of course, they would regard Britain as the weakest link in this. And of course, that then reinforces the war talk of our own failed, politicians and ex-military. But I mean, the truth of the matter is that the war is over and Russia has won it. There's now just a mopping up operation, and nothing NATO can do will change that situation, because even if they turned the economy over to a war-based economy tomorrow morning, they're way behind the Russians, at least 10 to 15 years behind on that one, so it's a non-starter. Well, ultimately, what will happen as a result of this is the collapse of the Western Empire, and the South Africans turning up in The Hague is also part of that process. And it's going to be very tumultuous, there's going to be rivers of blood, but at the end of it, we may finish World War III with a genuine United Nations structure which we can all live with going into the future.
Before the break, Patrizia Opulenza has done a very nice poem for us again, Enablers of Genocide. Question time. Antiques, the truth, woe betide. Whitewashing deaths in Gaza, genocide. The panel, a flannel, no substance each week. Get Martin invited on facts, he would speak. Claudia, the heckler, screaming out the truth, devoid of emotion, no sleuth, F the Bruce. Covering her tracks with her usual spiel, answers to questions, yet truth ne'er reveal. Instead of a vote on a ceasefire, 'tis true, MPs abstaining are a vile, spineless crew. Refuse to stand up, preferring to keep comfortable lifestyles. Just how do they sleep? Excuses without uses. Now the UN they blame, so aid will be stopped to enable death's game. October the 7th, LIHOP, insane. Fanny by gaslight, it's truly inane. Hospitals bombed, no medication gets through. Limbs of dead children on floor there to view. Gaslighting perfected, crying wolf on repeat. Ignoring the terror they eke out on the streets. In Gaza and Palestine. But this doesn't count while planning attacks on Iran they still mount. Yemen and Gaza not connected, they claim, as genocide continues. Cries for peace seem in vain. All eyes on Iran as the UK stores nukes for Biden, the yes man, to Bibi, the brute. Middle East a prime target, kerfuffle we all see. Wherever we look, a plan dastardly. War games insane with the devil they're all in. Blood on their hands for each massacre, each sin. If slaying never witness or genocide won't see, they can never be guilty. How wrong they all be. Apostates align at Satan's gilded shrine, enablers of genocide in Gaza, Palestine.
On his own hills, sweat and blood. Let us pray to Christ, the High Priest, who was appointed to represent men in their relations with God. Lord Jesus, in times past, you have lighted the way for your people through wise and holy leaders. May Christians always enjoy this sign of your loving kindness. You forgave the sins of your people when holy pastors prayed. Continually cleanse your church through their powerful intercession. In the presence of their brothers, you anointed your holy ones and poured on them your Spirit. Fill with your Holy Spirit all the leaders of your people. Nothing could ever separate the holy pastors from your love. Do not lose even one of those whom you have redeemed by your passion. Through the pastors of your church, you give your sheep eternal life, and no one can steal them from you, save the faithful departed for whom you lay down your life.
Well, he sounds like he's a bit part of a death cult there, doesn't he, old Jim Morrison? But the reason I brought up, that's from the 1979 film Apocalypse Now, originally on the Doors' debut album in 1967, and The End, at the end there. Before that, we had the Hymn from Finlandia, Treorchi Male Voice Choir, and the bit in the middle was from Leeds Cathedral Choral Evensong on Radio 3 this week. So anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to be looking at some of the, I suppose, investigations. Yes, well, one of the best investigators I've ever come across is this guy, Laurent Guillenot. For regular listeners, will have heard clips from his various films on this show over the last couple of years, particularly the one I remember, this is probably, I think it was in 2020, seeing it on, was it BitChute, and then going back later in the day to find it had been deleted. So you think, wow. And the name of the film is Israel and the Assassination of the Kennedy Brothers. Assassinations of the Kennedy Brothers. In it, Laurent makes some very, I think, fascinating conclusions from the facts that he digs out about the assassination of the Kennedy Brothers. Martin, what do you make of that? Because what he's saying is, whatever you think about the absolute fine detail, and he has brought a lot of it out, the ultimate... the ultimate, I think it was 1968, Bobby Kennedy was killed, who was JFK's brother, and 63 that Kennedy was killed. So the policy change towards Israel completely changed in that decade, and with the implementation of this new guy who had been the vice president, LBJ, or Lyndon Johnson.
Well, I think there's obviously there's lots of detail involved in the Kennedy assassinations and, you know, theories about who was behind it, and it's fairly convincing that the pro-Israel lobby would be, have means, motive and opportunity. Kennedy was opposed to the possession of nuclear weapons by the Israelis, for example. He was probably one of the last presidents that was able to stand up to them and say, hang on a minute, we're the boss here, you do what we say. That's no longer the case. And I think, you know, there's plenty of evidence to suggest they did have a hand in it, but it wasn't just them.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Laurent Guillenot now, and I'll put the full interview up on the show page at thisweek.org.uk later this evening.
The more I studied about the whole context, you know, where Kennedy came from and what happened after him, the more I realized that this very special relationship between the United States and Israel really started under Johnson. Of course, it had started before, but, you know, from the point of view of, from the time of Lyndon Johnson, Israel gained incredible influence on American foreign policy. You know, in 1967, under the Six-Day War, you know, we know that Lyndon Johnson kind of green-lighted, you know, the Israeli aggression on Egypt. And, you know, there was this USS Liberty affair. So everything changed. And this was also the time, the beginning of the neoconservative. They came, you know, they had their neoconservative conversion around the 1970s, just after Johnson. And so now we have a situation where we feel that the United States is doing something incredibly immoral by supporting Israel, as if now they are totally controlled by Israel, because it's definitely not in the interest of American foreign policy.
Just an anecdote on that, because I think that you're right about the Liberty affair being so important. I think he was called Silurian, who was an anonymous columnist in the Daily Telegraph, did a column, must be round about 2010 or something, 2008 maybe, which had fascinated me, which was about the involvement of George Morrison, the Admiral of the Sixth Fleet, who was the Doors singer, vocalist Jim Morrison's father, being involved in that incident and actually sending from the Sixth Fleet US Phantom jets off to bomb Israel. And literally on the way, those jets, they got orders from the White House, no, don't retaliate, even though the Israelis have attacked one of our ships, bring those jets back.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, this is all sorts of politics involved here. But, you know, at 67, while this was going on, the Admiral's son was like top of the charts in the United States and doing concerts all over the place. And then, of course, a few years later, I think it was 3 or 4 years later, Jim Morrison died in very suspicious circumstances. Basically, he was assassinated. So this is almost at the heart, you know, the culture of the United States was, you know, had integrity. So if the Israelis are going to try and sink an American ship, then they're going to get bombed. But Johnson made the intervention to make sure that there was no retaliation for this attack.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, he's reported by some Admiral Geis, I think, who claimed that Lyndon Johnson called him personally to ask him to call back the planes. That was not just, he was asked not only not to retaliate, but not to even rescue the crew of the USS Liberty. And the USS Liberty was a spy ship with no weapon, basically, and miraculously stayed afloat. But, you know, the purpose was to sink it without any survivor, in order to blame it on Egypt and draw the United States into the war. So Lyndon Johnson covered this Israeli crime. You know, there was no, it was covered up, and, you know, the survivors were asked to not say a word under the threat of prison or worse. And so, you know, Lyndon Johnson, when you realize, when, you know, Lyndon Johnson was probably, you know, a person with incredible personal ambition. But he was also basically from the beginning of his political career in 1948, he was Israel's man. And, you know, he had always been financed. As soon as he got into the White House, he brought, you know, all those people who infiltrated, you know, the White House, the Pentagon, you know, the State Department. And that was the beginning of the situation we had during already the time of 9/11, which I believed was an Israeli job or a neoconservative job, if you want. But neoconservatives, in my opinion, are basically should be called crypto-Zionist. There are people.
Yeah. Well, I think for anyone that's doubting that, there's a very good article on the WikiSpooks website, 9/11 Israel Did It All, The Proof in the World, which really goes through a fantastic amount of evidence of this really being part of a geostrategic project, which, if not led by Israel, most definitely benefits Israel. The idea really being as part of the Yinon plan to balkanize the Middle East, to give the United States excuses to intervene all over the place, really, and providing a sort of media press propaganda cover for those sorts of investigations. But anyway, look, before we get off the subject of the Kennedy brothers too much, there was the assassination of Robert Kennedy was particularly interesting in that it involved this sort of principle of mind control, MK Ultra, the idea that somebody could be brainwashed to do a killing, and even if they didn't succeed, there would be a real assassin there to make sure the person was finished off if this mind control zombie malfunctioned.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it. You summarize it. It's quite shocking to the case is very clear, actually. And actually, Robert Kennedy's son has studied that, and he's absolutely convinced that Sirhan actually did not shoot his father, because he shot with his revolver, but he was not aiming correctly. And Robert Kennedy was shot from behind, not by Sirhan. Sirhan doesn't remember anything, and psychiatrist confirmed that he doesn't remember. So there's definitely many people have, many specialist experts, you know, have concluded that he must have been hypnotized. So that brings, to mind MK Ultra and all these kind of things. It's quite amazing story. But what is even more amazing is that this Sirhan, this patsy, if you want, or this Manchurian candidate or whatever, was a Palestinian. And still today, just a few days ago, again, I read, there was a conference by Robert Kennedy, and he was introduced by a rabbi. It was in some kind of a synagogue or something. And the rabbi claimed again that Robert Kennedy, so, you know, Bobby Jr.'s father, he was introducing Bobby Jr. And he said his father was killed because he loved Israel so much. He was killed by a man who hated Israel. So, you know, that's an incredible story, an incredible thing, because in my view, you know, Robert Kennedy was killed by the same people who killed his brother. And I think it was basically Israel in the very general term that I explained before, with many people involved, of course, in the United States. So, you know, they managed to kill Robert Kennedy because Robert Kennedy was definitely not a friend of Israel. No Kennedy has been especially a friend of Israel, at least until recently. So, you know, they managed to get him killed by a Palestinian so that they can claim Robert as some kind of martyr who died because of his love of Israel, killed by a Palestinian terrorist.
So Bobby Kennedy assassinated in 1968, killed by a Palestinian, Martin. So we all need to be afraid of Palestinians.
Well, I think those who know about this topic will know that Sirhan didn't kill Kennedy. He was a patsy. And of course, what better patsy to have than a Palestinian patsy? Because that kind of stokes up the, you know, the evil Palestinians are trying to kill us trope. So it kills two birds with one stone.
What do you think of this idea of MK Ultra, this idea of having a mind control person who might go and kill people?
Well, what you do is you've got somebody who turns up, and they are a patsy. So they don't, in fact, you can't rely on them to kill Kennedy. You've got to have a professional shooter to do that. But, of course, you've then got the patsy with a gun in his hand saying, oh, he's the one who did it. This is how these things are done.
Okay, so last week we had loads of news about this guy, Valdo Calacane, who killed three people in Nottingham. Well, here's the report from Tracy Foster on News at 10. But listen out for the links to the UK intelligence services of this guy.
This was the moment Valdo Calacane's killing spree finally came to an end. But what we now know is that he'd been wanted by police for 9 months.
My honest assessment is that, no, I don't think that we could have done anything that would have made any difference and prevented what we now know happened on that dreadful day.
Barnaby Webber's mother says he has blood on his hands. But since recording that interview, the Assistant Chief Constable has issued a statement admitting that Nottinghamshire Police should have done more to arrest Calacane. But mental health services had also lost track of him. Calacane had been receiving treatment since 2020 for paranoid schizophrenia. In May 2021, he turned up at MI5 headquarters in London to surrender to them because he believed they were controlling him. In August, he admitted that he'd stopped taking his medication and had no intention of continuing with his treatment. A few days later, he assaulted a female police officer as mental health professionals tried to assess him. He'd been sectioned at this hospital 4 times after becoming violent, and each time he was discharged after being deemed safe to be treated in the community.
So this maniacal killer in Nottingham, Martin, decided a few months before he did his killing that he was going to travel all the way down to London from Nottingham. He managed to find MI5's headquarters at Thames House, went in and said, please arrest me because I think that I'm working for you.
Well, that sounds like classic paranoid schizophrenia, doesn't it? It doesn't mean he was working for MI5. I mean, they may manipulate people like this if they want to do things like we were talking
but
about.
But doesn't this flag up the fact that this guy is extremely dangerous?
Well, I mean, obviously...
And also, is it not possible that there was some sort of actual connection with MI5? The guy wasn't totally potty. I mean, you know, there are two sides to that, aren't there? Maybe he was mad. Maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was just saying, look, I've had enough of all these games you're playing with me.
Well, that's speculation, if you don't mind me saying.
Well, it's speculation on whatever side, that his visit to MI5 was motivated just by paranoid schizophrenia. Why would someone who was up in Nottingham decide to go and make a trip down to London to turn himself in?
Because MI5 are a thing that are out there that people can make part of their own personal.
Are you saying that
stuff?
MI5 don't experiment with paranoid schizophrenics?
They do, but you can't presume that's the case in this particular case.
Nobody is saying that this is evidence as certain that he's been being manipulated by MI5. But one of the most important things I think to understand is that the intelligence services do experiment with people with paranoid schizophrenia. And another thing which points to this potentially being an MI5 operation is 9 months this guy is walking around in Nottingham whilst there are warrants out for his arrest for assaulting a police officer, but the police don't arrest him.
All right. Well, I mean, I'm willing to listen to any kind of reasonable argument about what he may or may not have been doing. And I certainly think that the intelligence services do fish in these kind of murky waters, as you suggest. But if you know, it's all about the detail and the factual detail. Don't forget, lots of people have mental health issues where they think the security forces are involved, whether they are or not.
Yeah, okay. So the security forces also manipulate people, hypnotise people. This is one of the little games that they love to play. And so let's not make any assumptions one way or the other. But one thing's for certain is the families of those that died want a proper special inquiry into this, and they want to know why Nottingham Police didn't do anything. A very simple explanation might be that they were told not to do anything by MI5.
It's possible, Tony, but we're still, I say, speculative until we've got more detail.
Laurent Guillaume is also very interested in, he's got a kind of, well, a bit like me, he goes for one of these little obsessions from time to time. He's very interested in the medieval world, and he's also been looking at the contrast between the old Orthodox Constantinople and Byzantium in the medieval times, and in particular with Moscow and Russia now.
Byzantium has been one of my major interests for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, I started with my interest for Russia. You know, when I started to get to try to understand Russia, then quickly I realized Russian Orthodoxy is really Byzantine Orthodoxy, or coming from there. And I started to be interested in the Orthodox world and in the history. And I quickly realized that, there is a big hole in our worldview, in our medieval worldview, in what people, in what the average people knows about the Middle Age. You know, when we think about the Middle Age, we think about European Middle Ages, and we completely ignore that the biggest city in the whole Mediterranean world was Constantinople, and Constantinople was the bridge between East and West, and so I started to feel and investigate that there is a big lie in our own, in the autobiography of the West, you know, the West, how the West sees its own history. It is connected to the Crusades, because basically the West, the Western world, Western Christianity, Western Christendom, let's say, destroyed Eastern Christendom, especially in 1204 with the Fourth Crusade, where Constantinople was sacked by the Crusaders. And that was the beginning of the end for Constantinople. So after Constantinople fell, you know, finally, kind of survived, you know, but in a very small way until the Ottomans took it over. You know, during that time, the Western world was getting enriched by the culture of Byzantium, and later came the Renaissance, which was basically, you know, it really came from Byzantium, from Constantinople. So there is a phenomena where the Western world imagined its own history and emphasized its roots in Rome and in Athens, but wanted to erase, to forget, to deny that, in fact, all they got was from Byzantium. For example, all the Greek cultures, the Greek culture, you know, the philosophers, the historians, the tragedy and so on, came through Constantinople. You know, the Latins, the Franks, the Europeans did not get it directly from Greece, or did not get it primarily from the Arabs, as sometimes is said, but basically it was coming from the libraries of Constantinople. So it's very strange to realize that we have a very biased view of the Middle Age, and it's connected to what's going on today in my mind, because there is something much deeper than I thought in terms of resentment between the East and the West. It goes back to the destruction of Eastern Christianity by Western Christianity, but Eastern Christianity was not completely destroyed; it was inherited by Russia. Russia is today the Orthodox Russia. Moscow is the new Constantinople, is the third Rome. For the Russians see it this way, because they collected the heritage of Byzantium before Byzantium died. So and Russia has a similar position as Byzantium in the past, in terms of being the connector between East and West. You know, that's why Russia is looking east and looking west, exactly like Byzantium was looking toward Persia and toward Rome. So there is some kind of strange geopolitical story that is being replayed, you know, something that is what is happening today in terms of the clash of civilization between the Western world and the Russian world or the Orthodox world is somehow a repetition or a continuation of what was going on between Rome and Constantinople in the Middle Ages.
So that's French investigative journalist Laurent and filmmaker Laurent Guillenot. Martin, what do you make of this whole idea of the Orthodox tradition being pushed really out of Turkey and the Russians kind of picking up the flag?
Well, it's all well known if you have any knowledge of the Middle Ages historiography. And of course, the fault lines in Europe are between Western Catholic Christianity and Orthodoxy and Islam. And of course, those fault lines all ran through Bosnia when I was there in the 1990s. And of course, these historical conflicts don't never go away. They just constantly evolve and renew themselves.
And just to wind up this week, picking up on what Laurent was saying there, I'm just fascinated by the Protestants and the Church of England, particularly the establishment church in this country, and how absolutely useless they seem to be, particularly by putting this guy who's an oil man in as the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. And I had a conversation probably a decade or so ago with a guy called he calls himself a bishop. He's an autocephalous bishop, which means that he is not part of the Catholic Church, even though he is a Catholic, so he's outside of the jurisdiction of the Vatican. And I did organise the interview originally to talk about this guy, Montague Summers, who wrote a book, Witchcraft and Demonology, who for a while was based here in Bristol. But anyway, we strayed off onto all sorts of subjects. I asked him about the Illuminati, and I also asked him about how many bishops in the Church of England actually believe in God.
I would rather have a small church of true believers than a vast monolithic organisation of heretics and those that believe whatever they want to believe. I mean, there are groups within the various churches, like the Church of England, who clearly don't believe in anything whatsoever. Everything's explained away by psychology, and I mean, I can't understand why they become ordained in the first place. Not that their ordinations are regarded as valid by Roman and Eastern churches, but I mean, the fact is that they'd be better doing social work or something of that sort, because faith doesn't seem to enter into it. And those genuine Christians who are in the priesthood and the laity of the, for example, Anglican Church, who hold fast to the true doctrines, they regard themselves very much as Catholics. Not Roman, but they do regard themselves as Catholic.
So are you implying that there are fake Christians out there for wearing the reverence dog collar and the bishop's hats?
There are people who claim to be Christian, whether they're ordained or otherwise, who do not hold to Christian doctrine and non-negotiable statements in the Bible, particularly the New Testament, and don't even accept the resurrection as a fact, don't accept the miracles as really having happened in the material sense of the word, and much else besides, and question the whole concept of God the Father, and see that as something to be taken poetically and not to be taken literally. So, yes, I would say these people are not truly Christian, as would, of course, Montague Summers. To get back to Summers, he would have regarded them as heretics.
So what was Montague's major work, and do you think it's still important today?
Montague Summers was such a fascinating character in himself and his journey that it almost eclipses the more mundane aspects of being an ordained priest and latterly, in his case, as in mine, a consecrated bishop, which fewer even still people seem to be aware of, therefore representing the body of Christ, the church. I mean, there are many priests and bishops. There are few today, at least, and even in his time, there were not that many who accepted what had been accepted for centuries in terms of the supernatural phenomena, whether it's the miraculous or the demonic. I mean, a lot of people have said that he said these things and wrote these things and believed in these things for effect, but that's not how I see it. He struck me as being, and strikes me as being, extremely devout, and there are reasons why he became so, I believe, but his prose was solemn, archaic, and often impenetrable, nevertheless written with an energy, a conviction that carries the reader, as you've discovered yourself, forward, which makes it impossible almost to put his books down. He was no skeptic, and he didn't make the claims he made for effect or because it was more exciting. He absolutely, as I do, believed that the dark tales he shared with his readers were true, and that such demonic manifestations as vampires, for example, and those who are damned to be transformed into wolves through occultic means, really happen. Indeed, not believing in such things, according to him, was akin to heresy or worse. These things are not disorders of the mind, but of the soul. You won't find too many priests, fewer still in the Anglican Church today, saying these things.
No, you certainly won't. Very, very few. So that was Bishop Reverend, I think. I'm not quite sure. He gets very upset if you don't pronounce his reverendness correctly, and I'm doing it right this second. Sorry about that, Sean Manchester. So anyway, it's the Right Reverend Sean Manchester, autocephalous Bishop of the Catholic Church, speaking to me many, many years ago, about Illuminati vampires, basically, and also that something like three quarters or more of the Anglican bishops don't actually believe in God. And this was a headline in the Times from the 1980s or 90s. I'm not sure quite exactly. I can't remember what he said there. But anyway, fascinating chap. And when he talks about Summers, particularly Montague Summers, not Martin Summers, Montague Summers, Dennis Wheatley also mentions Montague Summers as somebody that influenced him in his writing. Like Aleister Crowley, Wheatley went to visit these people, sometimes stayed overnight with them as a particularly, quite spooky recounting of how Wheatley and his wife ended up in Montague Summers' house overnight in the bedroom, which was infested with spiders, which sounded rather horrible, and they got out as quick as they could the next day. In fact, they may even have left in the middle of the night because they just couldn't bear it in there. But the fact is that when Wheatley was writing his books about particularly The Devil Rides Out, which was made into a film by Hammer, he knew what he was talking about, and these things seem to have almost been forgotten in the modern age. The films that are being made today don't really seem to do the business, do they? Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to our two allotmenteers, Julie Parks and Stephen Pill, as well as, of course, to Steve Headley, former Deputy General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, and author of Derry Boy, and, of course, to former Ambassador to Syria Peter Ford, and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram if you dare. You can even put stories on there, but please don't chit-chat, gossip and burble. I'll just delete it, and maybe delete you too. So please do send me interviews, story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, the full-length interview, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. That's Martin's and I. And you can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Do please have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. If you want to download the app, there are possibly some changes being made to improvements being made to that at the moment. We've been streaming live from PRSC, the Arts Centre, on Stokes Croft in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqeuk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and on the app, of course. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show,
just let me know and I'll credit you here. Do please join us at 5 next Friday for Not the BCFM Politics Show. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Gentlemen, I don't know if you realize it, but tonight you're in for a special treat. No, not that. You only get that treat on full moons. Besides, I know there are a lot of young people out there, and I wouldn't want anyone to faint or blush or anything. The last time it happened, grown men were weeping. Policemen were turning in their badges. I get it. Everyone was intimidated tonight by all the security precautions and everything. Well, just remember, their motto is protect and serve.
Storm Riders on the storm, into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone, an actor out alone. Riders on the storm, there's a killer on the road, his brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday, let your children play. If you give this man a ride, sweet family will die. Killer on the road, on the storm, riders on the storm, into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone, an actor out alone. Riders on the storm,
Thank you.